Globalist agenda hour by hour. This is the War Room with Harrison Smith.
In a week and a half, President Trump has come out and viciously attacked myself and other prominent people that have warned about the Iran war being a total disaster, which has been proven to be. He calls me a low IQ loser and all the rest of this stuff. We can have a go. Now I'm fired. And he endorses the Democrat Party lawfare against me that the CIA and DOJ ran publicly, and that the same groups that targeted him ran the Paul Weiss law firm that did a $40 million settlement with him last year and admitted to criminal activity. So he's now siding with the actual criminals. But let's talk about the bigger issue first here. Trump had a 56 approval rating 8 months ago when Doge was roaring and Elon was there and all the rest of it. Now he's got a 33. He's lost 80% of his support in independents. The Republicans are going to lose the midterms massively coming up in just 7 months. And even Susie Wiles has told him that and told the press all that this needs to stop. But he doesn't care. He is committing political suicide for our own movement. And he's turning against all the major pillars of the movement, blocking RFK Jr., trying to get rid of the poison shots all of a sudden, giving total liability protection to deadly glyphosate, Roundup. He goes on and on. So I don't support this new Trump. But this isn't about his attack on me. It's about the craziness of this when, even on his own Truth Social and in polls, it is wildly unpopular. And he has all these neocon sycophants that were his enemies and never Trumpers praising him and saying how great he is, that we all need to be arrested because we work for Qatar. Well, I sure as hell don't. So here's where we are right now, ladies and gentlemen. We are at a crossroads, and Trump is committing political suicide. Use the Japanese term, seppuku. No one who has any brain cells can deny that fact. And as I said when this war started back on March 1st, it came out 5 days before that the intelligence agencies in the Pentagon gave him a report saying 90% chance this fails. Israel's lying to you. Iran's not about to attack us with a nuclear weapon. But he went with Netanyahu's lies and his Mossad chief's lies, who said the war could be won in 4 days and then Iran would fall. Now here we are into this almost, a month and a half or more. We've been proven right. I'm a loyal American. I supported MAGA because so much good was done compared to the Democrats. This is a new Trump. And it's so unhinged. He's the guy that had all these countless bankruptcies for casinos and hotels and, basically these pump and dumps. But then he looks at me that was shut down by $1.5 billion judgment that tried to shut me down that was totally rigged. And now he's siding with the people that attacked him against myself and others. So this is the new Trump. He can't be this stupid. He's made some deal with the globalists up above it. No doubt the Rothschilds are his biggest bankers. That's on record. They're the financiers of most of his properties. Not the Russians, the Rothschilds out of the UK. And he's sabotaging the midterms. This is a deal. He's not this stupid. And watch what happens in 7 months with the midterms. That is the facts. But, he's all saying, I'm fired. Fired from what? I'm not ever needing access to Trump. I don't, at the end of the day, care about what Trump thinks about me. I wanted Trump to be good. I wanted his policies to be good and not turn against what he stood for. But I'll tell you this, we are shutting down May 30th because the Texas receiver is cutting off, the satellites and everything. We have the Alex Jones Network, Ed AGN Live on X, right here at Real Alex Jones, on Rumble. Same radio stations will pick it up. All of it. We'll have a new site we're going to announce very soon. People will find us. We'll continue on. Truth is, our numbers are bigger than ever. What we're saying is popular. 80%+ of Americans are against ground troops. 70%+ against this war. Trump is not out of touch, though. He is run by the Israel lobby. I knew they influenced him before, but it's just a fact now. They brag about it. And that's where we are. And so we shouldn't have foreign powers running our country, our foreign policy, our domestic policy. It's just so sick. And I told Trump, if he keeps attacking his base, I don't want to attack him, but we have to because it's so crazy what he's doing, and it fits into the larger picture. So I'll be filing some detailed reports here in the next few days on all of this. Look for more right here on Real Alex Jones on X and the Alex Jones Show here on Rumble. Be sure to follow us here, and just God bless you all. Let's pray for President Trump to hopefully wake up, but I don't think that's going to happen. We have to continue to promote nationalism, conservatism, Christian basic freedom, constitutional government, free market capitalism, and support the great work of Elon Musk and others and the good Republicans that are out there that are absolutely horrified by this. I talked to a lot of people in the cabinet, in the government. They're all completely freaked out. That's how I get a lot of information, trying to get Trump back on track. Charlie Kirk thanked me for trying to stop the last Iran war back in June of last year. No one was going to lead to this. He thanked me for pressuring Trump publicly to release the Epstein stuff because that was the right thing to do, plus it's unpopular not to. That is where we are, ladies and gentlemen. And so people try to make this a popularity contest. Ooh, the president said you're not cool, you're crying. No, I'm crying over Trump destroying MAGA and really derailing our America First agenda. But it's okay. He just rode in on this wave. We'll keep fighting. There's a global awakening. The tide is turning against the tyrants. And that's just the facts. So we'll continue to fight here as I've done for 32 years. And I'll continue to stand up for Team Humanity. Thank you so much. And God bless you all.
And beg Iran for help that Iran cannot provide them. They're begging Iran, please let the Chinese ships through the Strait of Hormuz. Iran doesn't control the Strait of Hormuz anymore. There's other players in the game now that control which merchant ships come through those waters. It's not up to Iran. And you know, China had ambassadors meeting with Maduro the day Maduro was nabbed out of Venezuela. Excuse me. And what did they do about that? Nothing. They did nothing. Now, their other great oil supplier, Iran, is effectively neutralized and being not so slowly degraded by the United States military. And what's China doing about that? Nothing. They're doing nothing because I don't think they have any practicable options for what they could do that wouldn't make the situation worse for them.
Yeah, see, as I'm looking forward, I'm like, I don't see the situation getting better for anybody. Because, I mean, we're so tied in with China economically anyway. I mean, any damage we're doing to them, we're also experiencing. Europe is also experiencing this damage, right? I mean, what would be the positive outcome?
Well, who cares about Europe?
Well,
I don't care about Europe.
Well, no,
I mean, for sure, Europe gets a lot of trade through the Strait of Hormuz. China gets an enormous share of trade through the Strait of Hormuz. So, and we get a little bit. Yeah, we're going to take some hits off this too. But the hits that China is taking are orders of magnitude greater than we'll be taking. America, for example, we float on oil. If you look at an oil map of the United States, it's almost everywhere under the country. That's not China. China is the negative photograph of that. They have no oil. They've already announced that, you know, they do refine oil crude that they import, and then they'll export the refined gasoline and diesel. They stopped that. They stopped all exportation of any refined products. They're keeping it for themselves. They have maybe a couple of weeks of, you know, normal supply, then a couple of weeks of kind of half operational supply, and then they're out of oil.
Yeah, that's going to get – it's. I mean, things are going to get crazy pretty quick, right? Like, how long can this, you know, conflict in the Strait of Hormuz even be shut down and the world economy not enter into a catastrophic death spiral? Again, I see what you're saying. I get exactly what you're saying. I think you're right. When it comes to the calculus, China has a much shorter, you know, tolerance they're able to expend. But, I mean – are we just burning down the world economy? Like, how much harder is it going to be to restart all of this? Because, I mean, Qatar is shutting down all of their liquid natural gas production. They're shutting down factories that take like 12 months to restart again. So, I mean, is this worth it? Or, I mean, how's that calculus play out if so much damage is being done to so many industries in so many countries? Is China really suffering that much that it makes it all worth it?
Does it make it all worth it? Does it make it worth it not to have the boot of China on the world's neck anymore? I mean, I don't know. There's nothing that comes without risk, right? This could go completely bad. The entire world economy could freeze up. We could have a Great Depression on a global scale. That's all possible here. But there is no victory without risk. And Trump is the president who's taking these risks. The risks are real, but it's almost like if your family's threatened by some bad actor. So you pull out a gun and you say, stay back. I'm prepared to defend myself and my family. You don't really want to have to kill that guy. You hope it doesn't get to that point. You're hoping presenting the gun will give him a clearer view of what his practical options are and that he'll choose wisely. I think that's what Trump is doing. Now, is it possible you might have to shoot that guy? Is it possible he might pull out a gun and shoot you? That's all possible. But what's the alternative? Is the alternative not to defend yourself and your family? I don't think that's – I think that's what all the presidents preceding Trump for my entire political life have been doing. And where's that gotten us? I don't think it's improved America's situation. I think it's improved China's situation.
Well, yeah, China is certainly, you know, benefited from American foreign policy over the last several decades, which again is to me the frustrating part of, even if all this stuff is predicated on our opposition to China, it's like, well, you're the people that sold us out to China over the last 70 years. So, you know, this is sort of causing the problem and then providing the solution. So what would be an ideal outcome, do you think, for Trump? Because as far as I can tell, it looks like we're going for just straight up like failed state in Iran. We don't have anybody ready to take it over. Maybe the Kurds will take a section. I mean, but we're just talking factionalism, chaos. I mean, is that a positive outcome for the Trump administration? I guess that would put a damper on the Belt and Road operation. But again, at what cost? What do you think the question is, what do you think the best outcome would be from Trump's point of view?
Well, I mean, we may see the Kurds take some territory of Iran. I certainly wouldn't have any objection to that. A degraded Iran, I think, is largely in America's interest. We don't want it to implode. I don't think that's in anybody's interest. But the son of the former Shah is, there's a real challenge in Iran, right? So it's been run by this theocracy for decades. It's not like there's a recent outcast normal government that could just step in and take over. Right. The people who would be the apparently obvious alternatives to the theocracy, they've never run a government. They've never been judges. They've never been legislators. They've never been any of the things you need to function a government. Now, they did release some statements in the last few weeks saying, hey, we've been spending years working with experts to basically plan out how to run a government. We've been training. We've been practicing for that. And if that's the case, they may be able to step in with some foundational backing of America and put something together that looks like a working government. I don't know. That's one of the risks that we take. But is it better than having the apocalyptical theocracy? I mean, if there's no question, I think, in anybody's mind that if Iran got nuclear weapons, they would use them. They believe the future lies in an apocalypse from which their religious salvation comes. It's very difficult to sit back and say, well, let's let them get the nukes and see what happens.
See, I think I have a different view of this, because it seems to me like our motivation is largely apocalyptical. And the way that Lindsey Graham and, I mean, all of the leadership in America, certainly the evangelical leadership, and of course you have, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu and all the Israelis talking about Purim and, you know, the rebuilding of the temple. Now we've got, you know, the temple patches on the Israeli soldiers' arms. I mean, that all is about apocalypse and Armageddon. So, I mean, I don't know. To me, it seems like the Israeli side is the one that is driving us towards some sort of prophesized, great last battle. I guess they can be partners in this, right?
I mean, Israel has nukes, right? America has nukes. I mean, if we wanted to start a nuclear war for apocalyptic purposes, we're free to do that. We haven't done that.
And then we have not done that yet. I don't know. What do you think the odds are that we move in that direction? I mean, I'm just trying to play out like where this goes from here. I can't help but see a Vietnam style quagmire, sunk cost fallacy at a certain point. Again, I don't see what we're doing in Iran as being part of a wider strategically valid operation going on. It seems like we're flying by the seat of our pants and kind of retroactively trying to justify it by invoking prophecies and the apocalypse. So again, I would kind of rather have a government that you could negotiate with in Iran than just a chaos of murdering ethnic tribes, right?
But could we negotiate with the theocracy? I mean, my sense is we've been trying to do that for decades without much effect.
Well, we did have deals before, and again, it seems like they were willing to meet us when it came to nukes, but then we wanted them to give up their ballistic missiles. I mean, I if I was them, I wouldn't give up my ballistic missiles, because from their perspective, it's very much the same, right? The idea of somebody breaks into your house with a gun to kill your family. I mean, they're also looking at somebody holding a gun to them. So, where do you think this goes from here? Because again, I'm just seeing visions of Ukraine 2.0, Vietnam 2.0. I mean, this is a disaster as far as I'm concerned.
Well, were they willing to meet us on nukes? I mean, that's not my sense from the reporting. My sense is just days before these combative activities began, They were telling our representatives, American representatives, no, we're still determined to have a nuclear bomb. We even offered them non-nuclear grade fissionable material for energy purposes. And they said, no, it's not good enough. We're going to have a nuclear bomb. That's we're determined to have that. Well, so I don't think that's kind of meeting us in the middle.
Well, I'm not sure what the final, you know, well, obviously the final outcome of the talks was that they failed. But, you know, there'd been differing reports about what had been decided. But we'd scheduled another, you know, round of talks in Geneva, right? So, you know, we were talking with them, and it appears as though we were making progress in one way or another. Tehran is ready for nuclear concessions if U.S. meets demands, Iranian officials say. So again, you know, to me, it's like, all right, here are these people that were at least willing to talk to us that we'd had an agreement with back in 2015 that they had been sticking to as far as the observers from the IAEA had recognized. So again, I don't see how this benefits America at the end of the day. Maybe it hurts China, but I just see this as going to be, it's going to be another $1 trillion dune boggle, right? I mean, what's the positive outcome here?
Well, the positive outcome would be we have a rational government in Iran. Now, whether or not we get there remains to be seen. I don't see this as anything like the Vietnam morass or even the prior Gulf War morasses. We're not landing troops. We're not attempting to make them into a democracy ourselves. I mean, the way Marco Rubio talks about it, it would be great if they went that way, but that's going to be for them to have to do. In Vietnam, it was the whole environment was different. The weapons we could bring to bear were different. The enemy was in a jungle. It was very difficult. They had no real infrastructure to attack. Now in Iran, the moment they fire a missile, the infrared signals detected from space, and we're dropping GPS bombs on those locations within seconds of things being fired. So we're able to degrade Iran's military and ability in a way we were never able to practically do in Vietnam. So it's a completely different scenario from that perspective. Listen, if we start landing troops to occupy Iran, I'll be the first person to say that's going to be a hellscape, and we should absolutely not be doing that. I would favor impeaching any president who would do that, including Trump, but I don't see that happening. So that's not a major concern of mine.
Well, but don't we have to land troops? I mean, the only other option is bombing campaigns, aerial raids, and they've been doing that in Gaza. Gaza is a 25-mile square, you know, landlocked open-air prison, and they still haven't defeated Hamas. So yeah, when you talk about Iran, I mean, you're talking about 90 million people, area the size two times of Texas. I mean, it's not jungles, but it's equally as difficult terrain, right? So, but we can't...
Yeah, I don't think you can claim victory over a territory from the air. I don't think that's possible. As you say, we haven't done it in Hamas either. But what you can do from the air is degrade that political nation state to a degree that it's no longer an imminent threat to your own nation. Hamas doesn't have nukes. I think we can prevent Iran from having that too. And hopefully prime an environment in which rational people will take over the governance of that nation state of Iran. But in the meantime, they're not becoming increasingly closer to being an existential threat to the United States.
See, I just don't know if I haven't seen any evidence that they're, you know, an existential threat to the United States. I've seen that they're an existential threat to Israel, maybe. But I mean, where do you think that dividing line is? It seems to me like the thing that we're getting here is freedom of action.
I mean, they shout death to America at every opportunity, right? I mean, they proclaim it.
Yes.
They don't proclaim peaceful intentions to America. They're quite the opposite.
I would too if I was them.
Well, I understand. I listen, from their moral position, maybe that's an appropriate thing to shout is death to America. But as an American, I'm very concerned about people who shout that they're advocating for my death, securing nuclear weapons. That, to me, as an American, that's a bad plan.
See, I guess I'm more concerned about not doing the thing that makes us enemies overseas. Because, again, like how would it come about that a rational, you know, freedom-loving you know, power structure takes over Iran? I mean, that's just not going to happen. I mean, I guess that could happen in Gaza too, but like, it's not gonna. So why?
Well, I don't care if it's freedom loving. I just care that it's not a threat to my nation. If it's going to be a dictatorship that's not a threat to America, well, that's fine. They can govern themselves as they think best. I'll leave that up to them. I don't think they need to fly the American flag and have bald eagles and do all that kind of stuff. I just want them not to be a threat to my nation. However they organize themselves consistent with that mandate is up to them.
Okay, I mean, I feel like they're a bigger threat to our nation now than they were last week around this time, right?
I would say no. I mean, their Air Force is obliterated, their Navy's obliterated, their nuclear capability as it was developing is obliterated. I don't think they're stronger now than they were a week ago.
Well, no, not that they're stronger, that America is under. I mean, a week ago, we still had our base in Bahrain, right? So again, it's like starting this conflict, starting this fight just doesn't seem well advised to me. It seems like we were talking with them. I don't think they were an imminent threat. I mean, none of their missiles can hit us. They could potentially, you know, get nuclear weapons. I don't know if that's been degraded at this point. It seems like the best way to prevent them from getting nuclear weapons is to get them to agree to the IAEA inspections. So, you know, to keep a handle on their operations, but obviously that's not going to happen anytime soon. It seems like the belligerence with which we approach this issue has made the whole thing, you know, untenable and significantly more dangerous.
And I understand your perspective, and a lot of people obviously agree with that perspective. My view is just different. I don't see us as having provoked this confrontation with Iran. That's just not my view of events. Maybe it's just because I'm a substantially older guy than you are. But I remember when Iran took our hostages in 1979. I remember the decade after decade after decade, and Iran either directly or through proxies attacking American interests. This has been a fight that's been ongoing for many, many, many years. It's not something that just happened. We have a different president now. And the president decided, listen, we've been talking for a while. You have to judge people by their actions more than their words. He lost confidence that they were speaking with us, negotiating with us in good faith. He believed they were increasingly becoming a threat that would be impossible to practically defeat. In a year or so, he decided to act now. I don't think that's an insane decision. We can disagree with the policy. We can disagree with how we view Iran and its relationships with America and what we think might have happened if we'd gone a different way. But I don't see this as an insane policy position for the president to have taken. Very aggressive, for sure.
Well, yeah, and I would like to see some, you know, more well-explained outcome of this, like desired outcome, because so far, I haven't seen anything expressed that could be like, here's what we want. I mean, at least when we went to Iraq, it was like, we're going to bring them democracy. And it was stupid. I was against it then. Right. But at least it was an excuse. Andrew Branca is my guest. More on the other side. I'm really enjoying this conversation. You don't get a lot of back and forths like this about these very contentious topics, but he's a very smart guy. We'll be right back. Like my guest, Andrew F. Branca. You can follow him on X at The Branca Show and YouTube.com/The Branca Show. And we're talking the Iran war. And I got to be honest, Mr. Branca, I didn't expect you to be as in favor of it as you are. I don't want to put words in your mouth, and strictly because I feel like we're fairly aligned on pretty much everything I ever see you talk about. I think you hit the nail on the head. So I'm just kind of confused on how we're misaligned here. And you know, I don't want to be wrong, and I'm not certain I'm right. So I'm happy to have this conversation. I guess to me, it's like one of the things, I think the last time you were on, we were talking a lot about immigration and the flood of Indians mm-hmm. and stuff like this. I mean, is that not going to be a downstream effect? I'm worried about the 90 million potential refugees. If we just create a failed state, how many of them are going to go to Europe? How many of them are going to continue on to America? I mean, isn't this going to cause a lot of downstream problems that you're concerned about?
I mean, what Europe does is Europe's problem. I don't care what they do. America should not be allowing not only no asylum in America, no refugees in America. We shouldn't be allowing any third world immigration into America at all. That's a decision we get to make. The asylums don't force their way into our nation. We can close our borders. We've demonstrated that. If we choose to let more third worlders into our nation, well, we've just decided to make our nation more like the third world. I think that would be a bad policy. But the fact that we're acting outside in the world doesn't mean we have to allow tens of millions of asylum seekers in. Those are different decisions.
I suppose that's true. I still don't like the creation of the conditions that you know, brings about the, because you know, at the end of the day, I guess that's my thing, is I'm like, okay, maybe Iran, you know, ends up being less of a threat than it used to be. I'm But like compared to everything we have to deal with here, it's just the disconnect between what we have to deal with here and what's going on in Iran. Like maybe if we go to war with Iran after we somehow create conditions here in America where we don't have any more refugees, maybe if we controlled our immigration system and had deported everybody, then after we get done with that, we can go take care of Iran knowing that the refugees aren't going to be a problem. But you know what I mean? I just feel like this is not the time to be dealing with this stuff with Iran when we have all this other stuff going on.
I guess my response would be, we don't live in a perfect world where we get to solve our problems one by one in their entirety before we proceed on to the next problem. The world's complicated. There's lots of spinning plates. There's lots of things that are broken. I noticed when I was waiting to come in originally in the green room, you were the show was talking about payoffs for legislatures that had done bad things with children. That's horrific. I'm the father of four children. I think anybody that harms children should be buried under the jail. Yeah. But we can't say, let's solve that problem before we deal with the immigration problem, before we deal with the tariff problem, before we deal with the Iran problem. The world doesn't allow you. It's not like an old school karate movie where the bad guys come at you one at a time and you get to defeat them one at a time. Right. It's more complicated than that. And if you ask the Trump administration, they would say, and again, I'm not inside the Trump administration. I don't know exactly their thinking. All I can go by is what they tell us. They say they felt they could no longer afford to wait. They didn't have the luxury of further patience because of the scale at which Iran was building its offensive missile and nuclear capabilities relative to our ability to build defensive measures against them. If we did not intervene now, it would be too late. Maybe they're lying. Maybe they're making it up. But maybe they're telling the truth.
Yeah, I mean, they could be. Because from my interpretation, I think they're just kind of throwing anything at the wall to see what sticks. I mean, Marco Rubio said, well, they were going to attack, or Israel was going to attack, so we had to attack because we were going to get it. I mean, it gets complicated and you know, circular at a certain point. But, you know, again, I get the impression that none of this was well planned. I mean, now we're asking the Kurds to get involved. That seemed like an afterthought. Like we didn't know we were going to need something like that. I mean, tell me, because my interpretation is that he thought this was going to be like Venezuela. I was against Venezuela. I'm happy to admit that the Venezuela operation was a magnificent success. Even though I was against it, even though I would go back in time, I wouldn't say to do it. It was great. It worked really well. Nobody on our side died. Like, boom, done. If that had been what happened to Iran, I probably wouldn't be have much to say right now. It seems to me like that's what they thought was going to happen, and they did not expect the situation we're now in. Do you disagree with that?
I think I would, because in Venezuela, we went in with one particular mission to seize one person, Maduro. We did that, and that was the end of the operation, the military operation. That wasn't our mission in Iran. Iran, it was to decapitate their leadership structure and to degrade their ballistic missile, their drone capabilities. That can't happen in a weekend. I think they knew from the beginning it was going to take at least weeks for that to happen. Trump says 4 weeks. But, you know, like it's any kind of fight, anytime you're in a fight, even if it's a pretend fight, like you train martial arts, I do BJJ. When you start wrestling with someone, you don't know how it's going to end exactly at the end. Even if you know you're better than them and you're overwhelmingly likely to win, you don't know what all the intervening moves are going to be. You have to respond to the things they do in response to your actions. So there's a certain shake-the-box element to this. There's a certain uncertainty in the step-by-step progression. And at each step, almost like a chess game, what you're hoping to do is make the best move based on the information you have in that moment, and then you see how things develop, and then you make the next best move. But you can't predict from the start of a chess game exactly where all the pieces are going to be at the end. You just have to take it step by step and hope to advantage your position at each move.
Right. Certainly that's true. I get the sense that, you know, maybe they thought if we take out the Ayatollah, then, you know, they'll want to negotiate. Because it seems to me...
Well, isn't that true, though? I mean, I've seen reports that now they're trying to negotiate.
Well, I've seen the opposite. Because there was a report that Trump asked for a ceasefire and the Iranians said no. Because, you know, and maybe they're not rational actors in this, but, like, that's one of the things, right? You know, it's like in a fight, you think, okay, I'll just you know, run up and sucker punch this person and knock him out. And it's like, but what if they don't get knocked out? What if they just turn around and now you're in the fight? And now it's like, you can't just back off. You can't go, oh, well, we tried and it didn't work, especially because we see the way that they're pounding Israel right now, which again, I mean, this is another wrinkle to it, right? Is if this was all in totally like being orchestrated by Israel, they're kind of getting their butts kicked. I mean, Ben-Gurion Airport's on fire right now. So, I mean, how does that play into it? But it seems like Iran just sort of has this irrational, like, you know what? We're not even going to, like, it's a fight to the death now. And so now, like, we're in it. We can't just back out or else Israel gets totally destroyed. So it's like now we're in it, one, you know, to the end. And what the end looks like is sort of ugly, no matter what the outcome is. So I think we got in over our heads.
Maybe. I don't see it that way because it doesn't look incoherent to me. And if we were just spasmodically responding to things that totally surprised us, I think it would be a lot more incoherent. As far as Israel, listen, I mentioned earlier, if Europe makes bad immigration decisions and decides to accept tens of millions of Iranian asylum seekers, I don't care what happens to them from their own bad decisions. It doesn't mean I want harm to Europe. I don't have any animosity towards them, but if they make bad decisions, that's a them problem. And I feel the same way about Israel. I don't wish any ill on Israel, but if Israel makes decisions and they turn out to have bad consequences for Israel, that's an Israel problem. That's not my problem.
I agree, but they are becoming bad situations for us, right? I mean, we wouldn't even be in this situation as it stands now, let alone, you know, where we were last week, if it weren't for, you know, Israel's actions in Gaza and our unwillingness to restrain them there. So to me, it seems like this is being motivated by Israel. It seems to me like Israel is seeing this as their sort of last chance to take out Iran, which obviously they've harbored a desire to do that for 40 years. And they're seeing their PR collapse overseas. They know that the younger generation is not going to have the same support for Israel that they do now. So they need to become hegemonic and uncontested in the Middle East. So that seems to be the motivation, as far as I can tell. I don't see America benefiting.
The motivation
from this.
For who? For America?
Yeah, for America too.
The motivation for America?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, I mean, that could be, but I see an American motivation that doesn't require that it be driven by Israel. I mean, what the administration has been saying is we made a decision to decapitate their leadership structure, degrade their ability to employ ICBMs and drones against America, against our interests, against the Strait of Hormuz, against Europe. Their ICBM certainly can reach our NATO allies in Europe. Those are all American interests that have nothing to do with Israel. So does Israel play a role here? I would expect so. They're another American ally. All of this would not happen but for Israel. I see a coherent rationale for America to pursue this path in its own national interest that doesn't require our decision-making being driven by Israel.
Well, I mean, to me, it seems like, I guess you can make that argument. It's not sufficient to actually justify the attack itself. But like maybe retroactively or retrospectively, you could say, well, we can benefit from this. But I don't see the risk versus reward equation coming out on the reward side personally, just because we could be here literally 20 years from now in the exact same quagmire, having spent $1 trillion, right? I mean, what's the difference that you see between how we're entering Iran right now and how we entered Iraq back in 2003? I mean, there's a lot.
Well, we sent in a ton of troops. We sent in ground troops. That's the difference. Again, as I said earlier, if we send any substantive numbers of ground troops, you know, anything beyond like embassy protection Marines, you know, not zero, because sometimes you have to have a few troops there. But to actually occupy and secure and seize and control ground, substantive ground in Iran, I'd be absolutely against it. That should not happen. That's a bad plan. It was a bad plan the last 18 times we did it. It would be a bad plan now. But we're not doing that. So that's what I think the distinction is.
So that I guess is where I'm confused, because it's like, if you don't put troops on the ground, then what are you doing? I mean, again, as I'm playing out the different options, it's like, okay, if you don't put troops on the ground, that does away with any possibility of a, you know, occupied peace or anything like that. All you have then is the air battle, in which case, you know, we're back to Libya or Syria or any of these other like failed states that, you know, it's just sort of, we routinely have to pop up and crush whatever terrorist organization, you know, manages to cobble itself together in the ashes. Again, it's just like, if we don't put troops on the ground, like, what's the final outcome?
Well, first of all, I think we are degrading Iran's ICBM and drone capability, its threat capacity against the Strait of Hormuz, which is very important to world trade. I think that's worth doing in and of itself. But we're also shaking the box. Now, it's like a game of pieces, right? You shake the box and you open up the box and you got to put the pieces back together from an unpredictable pattern. There's a chaos element here. What we are doing is we're priming an environment in which the Ayatollah's gone. Most of its senior leadership is gone. Who's going to step into that vacuum? I don't know, but somebody will. There's a prospect. They're better for us, for America's interests, than the Ayatollah was. Could they be worse? Could they be worse than people spending decades threatening death to America, attempting everything in their power to secure nuclear arms, having a theocratic apocalyptic view of what the world should look like? I think it would be hard to get much worse than what was there before. So we've removed that. I'm not sure what we're going to get. I don't think the administration is sure what we're going to get, but I think we're hopeful we'll get something that's better. If that's not the case, we'll have to address that situation when it arises.
Well, I mean, the Ayatollah had a fatwa against nuclear weapons previously. I mean, there's no guarantee that the next one will be similarly inclined. But like, how does this play into things like Lebanon? I mean, they just told, you know, a million people to get out of Lebanon. You've got the and it's not Naftali Bennett. It's Smotrix going out and saying we're going to turn this neighborhood of Beirut into the new Khan Yunis. They're going to give it the Gaza treatment. I mean, the arguments about Iran being a threat to America. I mean, Lebanon, it's not a threat to America in any significant way, really. I mean, except for the stay behind networks that could potentially exist here. But again, those are going to
America's threatening to bomb Lebanon.
Well, we have used our pressure to get the Lebanese government to try to disarm Hezbollah and to give up a large portion of their, you know, sovereign land to Israel.
So I think maybe one driver of the apparent disconnect between us is not one of merit. It's one of perspective. So you obviously have a much better informed, a much broader perspective and view of things happening in the Middle East than I do. My view is much narrower. That doesn't mean it's better, but that could explain why we approach this problem from different directions. My entirely focus is what's in America's national interest. I couldn't give a shit what happens in the Middle East. I just don't care. What they do with themselves. I don't care what Lebanon does to Israel. I don't care what Israel does to Lebanon. It doesn't matter to me. I wish they would fix themselves and live in peace and not have people dying and murdering and killing and suffering all the time. That would be my preference. But I don't have any control over that. That's for them to determine their destiny and their part of the world. I only care about what happens in the Middle East to the extent that it becomes a threat to my nation.
Well, and then
I want that threat neutralized.
Absolutely. And that's where we definitely overlap, because the reason I'm so concerned about what's going on in the Middle East is because I do see how it informs and affects how we do things here. And I think obviously one of the big problems I've seen illustrated over the last couple of years, but especially in the last week, is the fact that there are a lot of people in America who seem to be making decisions on the basis of what's good for Israel. I mean, I think that's a major issue. And again, I just wonder if these decisions are even being made with our interest in mind.
You should have Ben Shapiro on the show. I'm sure that's his perspective, I would imagine. It's not my perspective, though. I don't speak in defense of Israel. I think Israel, like any nation, is going to pursue its own national interest. I think that's appropriate for any nation to do, but it's not of concern to me. And if they make bad decisions that have bad consequences for them, that's on Israel to deal with.
Yeah, no, but I'm talking about when that affects, you know, American behavior and the way American power is expressed. Yeah. Because, yeah, to me, I don't care, you know, what Israel wants to do, except that there's a bunch of Israelis here that are going to, you know, rope us along with them, right? I would prefer we don't have that. How do we solve that problem? Because then you don't have to care and I don't have to care. Neither one of us can care, you know, have to care about the Middle East if they didn't drag their issues over here.
Yeah. So, I mean, American politics is messy, right? There's a lot of drivers of American politics. Israel, I expect, is among maybe the most powerful of those. Often it's difficult to see what the drivers are and how they're working because these are backdoor arrangements. I'm not suggesting that doesn't exist. I presume that does exist. And all our NATO allies do this. You know, every nation, again, is acting in its own national interest or going to influence the U.S. in their national interest to the greatest extent possible. Maybe Israel's exceptionally good at that and good at making America act counter to our own interest because it's favorable to Israel. I'm amenable to that argument. The solution to that is to have different politicians. The solution to that is get rid of people who are amenable to that kind of corruption, whether it's from Israel or any other nation, and replace them with people who are less amenable to that kind of corruption. This applies to the legislatures who are using our tax money to pay off people that they've harassed in a variety of ways. It applies to our politicians who flood our nation with third world migrants, tens of millions of them who will never assimilate, never be Americans. All they do is make America less America. These are all terrible things that are happening. And the reason they're happening is because of the politicians we have. Frankly, I see in the Trump administration, really the only avenue to have a hope of saving America. It doesn't mean I have to agree with everything Trump does. I certainly don't. But the Democrats are against our national interest. They are progressive fascists. They want us to be, they want to rule over us like a bunch of kings over a third world feudal society. The Republicans, the classic Republican Party, these are the John Thunes, the Cornyns in Texas. These are just rhinos. They don't really have America's interest at heart either. They have their own wallets at heart. They're happy to be loyal opposition to the Democrats, getting rich at the trough, never having to be in responsibility, never having to make hard decisions that might potentially have negative consequences for which they would have to take the heat. And then you have what's effectively a kind of third party. Now, third parties don't work in America. They've never worked, not since Ross Perot or any other time. But Trump has effectively launched a MAGA party, an American First Party, that is taking over the Republican Party. It's a slow process. It's a slow process because of the inherent nature of our governmental structure. You can only replace a congressman every 2 years, and the reelection rate's like 90, 95%. They're very difficult to unseat an incumbent. You only have a shot at a senator every 6 years, president every 4 years, federal judges never, never, unless we get enough seats in the Senate to start throwing some of these federal judges out, which, God willing, will happen sometime in my lifetime. That would be enormous. But it takes a long time to change these people out. I see that happening in the Trump administration. I see better people coming in, replacing rhinos, displacing Democrats. And that's really my hope for the future. That's why I'm not a black pillar. It doesn't mean Trump's not going to make bad decisions. He does. It doesn't mean he's not going to make bad endorsements. He does. Nobody's perfect. Trump's not perfect either. But I try to look at these things directionally. Is the overall mass of direction, effort, inertia of direction, moving where I want to see America move? And I have to say, I do see it doing that.
Well, I do too, in terms of the long-term view. That you're definitely right, as in, like, eventually the people that are in office now are going to die out and younger people are going to move in and they're going to be much more aligned with the MAGA, you know, Trump vision of things. But it seems like that's the long-term, like, tidal shift going on. But in the meantime, there's this constant back-and-forth battle where it seems to me like most of the good people from the Trump administration are not able to get what they need done. They're being pressured out. And the swamp is just, like, you know, latching onto him and pulling him in slowly. I mean, the fact that he's, like, best friends with Lindsey Graham now. So there's this, like, short-term kind of, like, infection from the swamp taking over MAGA. But over the long-term, I think you're right that the groundswell impetus is certainly on the side of the not neocon, the nationalistic, youthful MAGA Americans. Is it going to happen fast enough? Like, I guess this is a race against time at this point.
Well, first of all, I have to say I completely agree on Lindsey Graham. I scream at my computer every time I see Trump standing next to Lindsey Graham. It drives me crazy. But that's not a new friendship. That's not the swamp coming in. He's always been in orbit around Trump. The change I see happening tends to be change in a good direction for America. I think Pete Hegseth is enormously better as Secretary of War than anybody we had under Biden or Obama or the Bushes, for that matter. I think Marco Rubio, who I didn't think much of as a senator from Florida, I think is just a tremendous, tremendous secretary. Whether you agree with his decisions or not, even if you disagree with him, you can't disagree with the expertise he's bringing to that office. He does what he's doing with great proficiency. Lindsey Graham, I just I will not be sad the day Lindsey Graham walks off the political stage for the last time. But the changes I'm seeing happen are changes in the right direction. And to me, that's very encouraging. I've never seen anything like it before. And the first president I ever voted for was Reagan. So I've been around a hot minute watching this stuff. And I really have hope for the future of America for the first time. And I'm far more than I had under Trump's first term, for sure.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I've been trying to cling on to that hope. It's just, it's been a disappointing year for me, Bronco. I mean, we're not getting any deportations. It's like, it seems like things are falling off. Again, I agree that, and the trajectory and certainly the will of the American people is absolutely going in the right direction. It's just that it's the two-party system and the entrenched Republican interests that are really talented at exerting their priorities over the American people. But hopefully we can continue.
The judges are a real problem. The federal judges are a real problem. But again, we just had, was it yesterday? Just yesterday, a unanimous Supreme Court decision that checked the authority of the unelected, black robe, tyrannical federal district trial court judges to impede deportations on asylum claims. I mean, again, that's another step in the right direction. But it is a war. America is in an existential war for survival. In any war, you're going to have wins and you're going to have losses. And what you're hoping for is you have more wins than you do losses. But the losses are going to come too. And we can't despair every time one of those happens, as long as we're moving directionally in the right movement.
I just want to stomp my enemies into the dirt. I don't want to lose. I want to win. But absolutely, I understand. This has been a surprisingly white-pilling conversation. Thank you very much. Andrew Bronca has been my guest at The Bronca Show on X, on YouTube as well, at The Bronca Show. When do you air? Daily?
Yeah, pretty much every day, 11 a.m. Eastern time. I live stream on YouTube, X, and Rumble.
There you go, 11 a.m. Thanks so much for being with us, sir.
Thanks, man. Take care.
You too. All right, folks, we'll see you tomorrow. This has been The War Room. Go to thealexjonesstore.com to support us. It's the only way that we'll be here to have these types of conversations, talk about these types of topics. I just want to go to one more clip of the Supreme Court discussion that occurred today about birthright citizenship. And this just shows you how not fit for purpose our current system is. It is literally incapable of changing for the modern age, and it's going to destroy us if we don't, figure this out and figure out a way to deal with this. Again, the proper way to deal with this would be for the Congress to actually go in and rewrite the 14th Amendment, abolish the 14th Amendment, and write a new one just saying we're not doing birthright citizenship anymore. That's ridiculous. That was maybe fit for the 1860s, but we're in 2026, and it just genuinely doesn't make it. No other country in the world has this. So again, it's not like we're like, well, we got to figure out how to do that. How do we even do it if we're not doing birthright citizenship? It's like, well, why don't we just do what every other country in the world does? How about that for a start? Not that complicated, but we got to go through the Supreme Court, which I don't even understand anyway. So many of our problems have come from Congress and the Senate just giving up their power. In fact, I've got a video today of Speaker of the House of Congress, Mike Johnson, saying, well, Trump says it's not a war. He says it's a, military operation. So, we don't really have anything to say about it. We only come into effect when it's a war declaration. It's like, so you're giving up. You're surrendering your right to have a say over whether America goes to war. This isn't a matter of, checks and balances. This is, you are abandoning your role as the check and balance. You are surrendering your prerogative to the executive. And the same thing happens with the Supreme Court. They, instead of writing laws, allow the Supreme Court to basically write law from the bench. And even that is a little bit confusing because the Supreme Court will come out with decisions and then the liberals just ignore it. And it looks like it doesn't matter. I mean, they come out with a decision about, you're not allowed to do DEI or affirmative action. And the colleges just openly say, we're still doing it. We're just calling it something different. And that's just allowed, apparently. It's a Supreme Court decision. They're violating it. Nothing happens. Happened again today. A judge blocked the Trump administration from terminating Biden-granted parole status for up to 900,000 immigrants. The Supreme Court decided that these little judges could not issue nationwide injunctions. But they do. They just keep doing it. So it's almost like, okay, even if the Supreme Court says that birthright citizenship is no longer legal, will the left even change their, they'll just keep giving out citizenship to whoever's here. they'll just act like it never happened. So this whole thing is broken. Let's go to clip 51. This is just how broken it is.
Based on Chinese media reports, there are 500 birth tourism companies in the People's Republic of China whose what business is to bring people here to give birth and return to that nation.
Having said all that, you do agree that that has no impact on the legal analysis before us?
I think it's, I'd quote what Justice Scalia said in his Hamdan dissent, where they have, where it, like their interpretation has these implications that could not possibly have been approved by the 19th century framers of this amendment. I think that shows that they've made a mess, their interpretation has made a mess of the provision.
Well, it certainly wasn't a problem in the 19th century.
No, but of course, we're in a new world now, as Justice Alito pointed out to you, where 8 billion people are one plane ride away from having a child who's a U.S. citizen.
Well, it's a new world. It's the same Constitution.
It is, and as Justice Scalia said, I think in the case that Justice Alito was referring to, you've got a constitutional provision that addresses certain evils, and it should be extended to reasonably comparable evils. He said that about statutory interpretation. I think the same principle applies here, and I think we quote that in our brief.
Thank you, Justice.
Again, it's just like deliberate ignorance or something. I don't know how exactly to phrase it, but that phrase, it's a new world, but the same constitution. Yeah, that's a problem. That's like a really big problem. If these things that are occurring now were not foreseen by the people that wrote the laws, then you've got to change the law to fit with the modern reality. What the hell are you talking about? This is a problem. I mean, the Constitution is the greatest, you know, document ever written, but it's supposed to be updated. The point of the Constitution is it's supposed to be routinely updated to deal with a new situation. Robert seems not to think so. So 8 billion people, one plane ride away. Robs was just like, well, some guys wrote a law in 1868, so I guess they're all Americans. You know, the phenomenon of prepping seems to go through like highs and lows. And it feels like I remember back when Obama was president, prepping was like the big thing. There were reality shows about it. Everybody was storing food and stuff. Because I think nobody had hope that it was ever going to get any better. Then Trump got elected, and I feel like prepping kind of like fell, you know, wasn't as culturally relevant anymore. But now we're on the cusp of World War III, nuclear exchange, total destruction, fuel rationing already taking place all over the world. And people are starting to get prepared again. Well, the best way to get prepared is to go to thealexjonesstore.com. Get yourself an Alex Jones signature Faraday bag bundle. The bag itself is well worth the full price in order to keep your electronics safe and avoid the electromagnetic waves that may result from a high-altitude nuclear explosion. But it also comes jam-packed full of other great goodies like the Tactical Trench Knife, the America First T-shirt, MK Ultra plus Atomic Defense, a ton of other great supplements. All together, you could buy them individually for around $600. We're giving it all to you for less than $250. And for VIP members, it's only $199.99. So do not wait. Go to thealexjonesstore.com/Harrison. If you want to let them know who sent you, get your Faraday bag bundle for a third the price that it could sell for. It could probably sell for a lot more than that, actually. It's really high quality stuff. Get it today. We're running out of supplies. Get yours while you can. Better to have it, not need it, than need it, not have it. Do your prepping before you need to be prepped, folks. And with that, I'm very, very happy to welcome my guest, Royce White. He is a native of Minnesota's Twin Cities, born and raised in St. Paul's historic Rondo community, a standout basketball talent. He was named Minnesota Mr. Basketball in high school, starred in Iowa State University, leading the Big 12 in nearly every major statistical category, and was selected 16th overall by the Houston Rockets in the 2012 NBA Draft. His professional career extended to championship-winning seasons in Canada, where he earned MVP honors and set records, as well as stints in the Big 3-on-3 league, where he currently serves as co-captain. And of course, it goes on and on. And typically, you know, we would tout your political acumen and all this stuff, but actually, the ball games are important now with what's going on in America. You can follow Royce White by visiting his website, roycewhite.us, or by following him on X at highway_30. Royce, thanks so much for joining us today.
Good afternoon, brother. Good to be here with you.
I'm glad you're here, and I feel like you're the perfect person for the big story that broke yesterday about Chicago Bulls player Jaden Ivey being essentially booted from the team for expressing just the most moderate disagreement with the LGBTQ pride agenda. As somebody with experience in the NBA, what's your take on this What do you think of the first of all, what do you think of the reaction that he was actually kicked from the team for what he said?
We're living through a color revolution. That was my initial reaction. Color revolution is here. It's on. It's happening. And my thoughts are always now centered around the global. And in my campaign and running for U.S. Senate, and even when I ran for Congress, one of the things I said often on the trail was that the global affects the local. And I'm constantly thinking about the geopolitics, because how could you not? I mean, we're on the brink of a world war, right? Yeah. As you said. And it just dawns on me that in the vein of what Alex said yesterday on social media and many others in the America First movement who are opposed to the war, it shocks me that many of our detractors or critics out there, like the Mark Levins, don't see the crisis of attacks against Christians here at home just as, if not more, dangerous and insidious than whatever dangers there are a world away in the Middle East or anywhere else on the planet. And that was my initial thought, is like, this is the crisis against Christianity and of our country that we should be focused on. When we say America First, this is exactly what we're talking about. And how could we let this stand, even from a legal and jurisprudential standpoint?
Yep.
You know, they're going to make 1,000 excuses and say, oh, well, a private company has the right to fire who they want and terminate who they want, just like the social media platforms have a right to censor who they want. At some point, our monopoly antitrust laws, at some point, there have to be Christian discrimination lawsuits that protect Christians. Christians are not covered under the law in this country, and that's become extremely obvious.
Yeah, and it is extremely ridiculous because of the, you know, inequity of the way that religions are talked about. I mean, nobody would kick a Muslim off a team for opposing LGBT. They'd be celebrated and uplifted. I mean, the inequity is really glaring when it comes to Christianity, and it's making some people hypocrites. I saw this, and I think this goes to exactly what you're talking about. Dana Leish, you know, the lady, says the Bulls are punishing a player for being a Christian. This is religious discrimination. Now, she's right. I don't disagree with her. But then somebody else pointed out, you were just supporting this 2 weeks ago when it was Kyrie Prejean Buller, who, of course, was kicked off of the, you know, White House Religious Tolerance Board for promoting her Christian beliefs. So, I mean, this is a really big issue. And, you know, Jaden Ivey sort of brings it to the fore in popular culture. But, I mean, anti-Christian discrimination is really heating up rapidly. Can you talk a little more about that?
Yeah, no doubt. And I think the Jaden Ivey story is sort of on three fronts. The first front is, obviously, if the left, the contradiction, if he had come out as gay and he had been let go or released from the team because he was homosexual, the entire left would have cried discrimination. Obviously, I mean, that kind of goes without saying, and they would have demanded legal reparation for it. By the way, for the anti-LGBTQ hatred, bigotry from the NBA. So the double standard is pretty clear, and I think, you know, maybe even more importantly, but certainly just as important, is this color revolution. This stuff, from a legal standpoint, has reached a level of national security threat. And I do think it's that serious. I mean, people will look at it and say, it's just another NBA player. He can't just be saying whatever he wants. No freedom of speech without consequence. Well, actually, I think we need to, and as you were alluding to in the previous segment, we need to start to evaluate how to properly interpret freedom of speech in the workplace and when it comes to corporations.
Right.
And if we don't do that, then we don't have freedom of speech. Actually, it's just a fictitious idea, much like the rule of law when you have corrupt Supreme Court justices. But, you know, even when it comes to freedom of speech, it's like, yeah, sure, a company has a right to its own freedom of speech in a way. Every corporate entity has a right to express itself how it wants to and fire and hire who it wants. But in principle, it should be trying to, at least on face value, uphold a fair amount of equity, as you would say, as mm-hmm. you could put it, equity when it comes to the value of freedom of speech. And it's like they're not even pretending that freedom of speech is a value that they hold in any regard. And it's become widespread on the left across the entire corporatocracy. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, it's the freedom of speech piece just comes and goes. It blows with the wind, and we can't have it that way. And ultimately, if Christians keep getting crushed like this under the weight of this corrupt color revolution, my God, I mean, there won't be a place for us to you know, celebrate Holy Week here in the near future.
So what do we do? What do we do about? I mean, are we just not standing up for ourselves enough? The crew just pulled up a headline, and of course they're going to say MAGA cries about Christian discrimination. But there's this inequity. I feel like we need even a better word, because I always say, like, it's not as if, well, a Christian person says something and a Jewish person said the same thing and only the Christian's getting, you know, punished. It's like, Right. Okay, a Christian basically said, I think LGBT is kind of unrighteous. That's it. That's what he said. That was the big crime. He gets fired from his job. Meanwhile, you know, well, hell, I mean, especially when you look at the corporate thing with the NBA, Miles Bridges was a guy who was arrested and criminally charged with multiple felony counts of domestic violence and child abuse after an alleged assault on the mother of his children. He only got a 30-game suspension and remained with the team. Meanwhile, you say that Pride Month is maybe not the most righteous thing in the world, and you get cut. So there's just an inequality and a total unbalance of the way this is being treated.
Can we go to this for sure? I mean, the NBA. The NBA trying to act like they're the moral arbiter of anything based on this kid's comments is completely dishonest and reprehensible. But can we take it down to this level? I don't want to give any merit to the allegations against Miles Bridges, because we know how prominent the Me Too feminism is as well, right? Sure. And on face value, at least, you say this thing happened in the public, so it has a sort of ramification, a ripple effect. You're not treating it fairly. Okay, cool. But the Miles Bridges thing, I know plenty of women who get in a fight with their boyfriend or child's father or husband and say, oh, he beat me up, he's hurting the kid. And we got to put a stop to that, too. That's also part of the legal crisis in our country. But, let's take it down to this level. And I was saying this earlier on my daily call-in show, and now we're doing it in the morning at 7 a.m. I got to get you to come in at 7 a.m. if you're ever up that early and be a guest. But
I stay up that late, maybe.
We'll have you do a 24-hour hold through to the show.
I'd wake up early for you. That'd be fun.
You know, this even communism, right? Like, and I was saying earlier this morning that we have to start the attack on us through language is profound and significant. And even communism, and today I used the term Fox News communists, and I'm sure that would blow a lot of conservative folks' minds, not the people who watch this show, but just, you know, in general. And the reason why I say is, like, we have to start to really hone in on some of these definitions that we just casually have used over the years. And I think that's true of freedom of speech. But I'll give you an example, and it's not unrelated to the NBA, because they have a significant Jewish lobby influence. I mean, Adam Silver's father was the founder of Prokshire in New York City, which was the sine qua non of the legal Jewish sphere of influence in New York City and maybe the entire modern world. I mean, Prokshire was the law firm that the Jewish folks went to, because the WASP law firms didn't accept Jews back then, which is just a matter of historical fact. But So it's not by accident Adam Silver's father is the commissioner of the NBA, and they're all lawyers. And the things that they push in terms of the policies and even the way that they treat some of these players is all intended to be a part of the control of the narrative. Communism, for example. Okay. And we're in a war. And it's like, if you believe in the socialization of risk on money that you print that doesn't really exist, on the backs of future working class sons, daughters, grandsons, granddaughters, and then you try and paper the whole thing over by placing the interest and burden back on those same people, and then you have a global dollar empire that's based on your currency, you know, the strength and value of your currency, or the faith in your currency, you're a communist. Like, if you print money that you don't have, and then you send it to a military industrial complex for a world away, and you socialize the risk on the working class, you're a communist. And we just have to get razor sharp about how we define these issues. Because right now I'm saying anybody who's supporting this war in Iran, in theory and in principle, is a communist. Now, I'm not saying there's not a certain level of socialism throughout our entire country and throughout our entire society, American society or culture, because there is a certain amount of socialism we accept. But if you tune into Fox News, they'll go, Governor Tim Walz, he's unfit to be the governor of Minnesota or any state or certainly vice president, because he said socialism, one man's socialism is another man's neighborliness. And I would certainly agree that there's only a degree of separation, if that, between socialism and communism.
Right.
And so from the halls of the Capitol here in St. Paul to the locker rooms of the NBA to the front line of the war there in Iran, all the way to the CCP in Beijing, we are under a communist color revolution. And it's quite clear, actually, once you kind of just step back from it and let it be what it is. It's very clear.
And it's sort of like, I mean, they still privatize the gains, though, don't they? They socialize the losses and private. So we're really getting the worst of everything.
We get
the worst
communism.
Parts of capitalism, worst parts of communism. It's a smorgasbord. We pick and choose only the That's worst right. parts. But no, you're exactly right. And I want to drill down on a couple things you mentioned, which is the pressure that comes to bear on these players, because this seems to be a little bit different than normal. And I wonder if this is a sign of really a significant change in the culture, because typically what would happen, we've seen this before, an athlete would come out, they'd say something, I don't want to do Pride Night. And then it was like they were taken into a back room. God only knows what machine was hooked up to them. But the next day they'd come out going, I'm so sorry. I let my team down. I let my family down. And I just want to apologize. And it's like, what did they do to you? You had a firmly held religious belief yesterday. You're denouncing it today. What do they do to people in between these two announcements?
I could tell you exactly what they do, because it happened to me. They threaten you. That's what they do. See, people, and this is, I probably should have led with this. I'm caught up in the geopolitics. I'm running for U.S. Senate. But as far as a personal anecdote about the NBA and how it works, people forget that I fought for mental health policy, not the woke transgender mental health policy. I mean legitimate, like, hey, people are struggling with alcohol abuse and drug addiction and anxiety and depression and PTSD from growing up on the south side of Chicago under Marxist Democrats makes you feel like you lived through Fallujah.
Right.
It's about a degree of difference between Fallujah, Iraq in the 90s or 2000s in the south side of Chicago.
Right.
But, I fought the NBA on mental health policy then, and they're so brazen and arrogant. They actually had the audacity to tell me, young man, you're right about the mental health crisis. You're right about the lack of policy. But who are you to force us to do it? You don't have any money yet. You don't have a lot of notoriety or fame. And we are the gatekeepers to the very things you would need to push this cause forward. So you can either shut up and wait until you're a little more famous and rich to be a trailblazer, a pioneer about this specific social issue, which has exploded now nationwide and worldwide. There's a full-blown mental health crisis. I would say it's more in pathomania and, mass formation psychosis. But, all in all, it's a mental health crisis.
Yeah.
And they told me straight up and down, you can shut up and play along, and we'll help you do everything you want to do.
Oh, sure.
Or you can keep talking and you'll be, a joke in the ash bin of history. And I actually told David Stern in a conversation that the both of us had that he was going to die before I did, and that God will not be mocked. And it, at the end of the day, they could keep their money. They can have their money. They can have their superficial fame and status. But here I am anyway, and I'm going to continue to fight. A lot of these players don't have that same courage. They feel that when you grow up as a basketball player from 5 years old, that's right. All you've ever done, especially with any rigorous discipline, your entire identity is wrapped up in the sport. And so you finally make it to the pinnacle. Your dream comes true. And you have these people who you've never met pull you into a black room, no pun intended, pull you into a back room and threaten to take your dream away from you. Of course, a lot of people are gonna fold under that pressure.
And it's social pressure too, isn't it? That's what I always assume, because I try to picture how these conversations go, and I always imagine the, hey, look, we understand you have a really, you should feel strongly about this, and we respect that, but do you really want to make the rest of the team suffer? You're going to really cost these guys a championship if you keep going like this. Is that really what you want to? I mean, how much is that sort of pressure used, or is it more just blunt? I mean, the way you're saying it, it sounds like they're just straight up like, we will destroy you, so shut up. I mean,
the loose camaraderie that comes through in the promotion of basketball is just that. It's very loose behind the scenes. I mean, they may try and run that gamut on you, like, hey, you're going to mess up the chemistry if you. But you got to remember, Michael Jordan, the greatest player of all time, took his own private plane away from the other players because, hell, he was Michael Jordan. And in many ways, he had earned that right. And I'm not against that. I mean, from a meritocratic standpoint, if Michael Jordan wanted to take two unicorns to the basketball game, fair play to him, right? Because he earned that.
He earned it.
He's the greatest of all time. But, you know, that's probably not as much as your agent would come to you. You know, maybe your financial advisor, maybe, you know, somebody from one of the shoe companies from the endorsement side of things, maybe your publicist, right? And they have these backdoor channels to the league or the commissioner or you know, the team administration. And there's a conversation that happens behind your back about the, you know, the betterment of your career and your financial stability and your mother and father. They get them on the phone or on the plane to come in and say, hey, don't forget, you know, we got to keep paying for your little brother's private school.
Right.
Right. So they use the social pressure in that way. And then when all else fails, they'll just wage a full-blown media propaganda campaign against you like they're doing to this young man right now.
Yeah.
There's actually a thread of social media that would suggest this kid isn't good enough to have an opinion that's controversial, which is blatantly immoral, right? Just in principle. I mean, who cares how many points he's scoring? Why should that even impact what he's saying, if he has a right to, and if it's true? And then obviously that he's bigoted, right? That he's hateful for even saying there's an unrighteousness to this propaganda, which is them doubling down on the communist color revolution, that there are no sexual ethics or morals anymore, unless your name is President Trump or anybody else who wants to run for office. Then any woman you ever slept with or even looked at becomes a cudgel that's going to be used against you.
Yeah, that's very true. And of course, you know, this goes back. There was a decision yesterday about conversion therapy. My argument always was like, you can either ban both or ban neither, but obviously there's an ideological monopolization that's going on where they're saying you have to promote pride, which is a moral framework that is different and contrary to Christianity. They're saying you cannot promote Christianity, you have to promote pride. I mean, if that's not a violation of the fundamental, you know, purpose of the First Amendment and freedom of religion, I don't know what is.
I'm not sure how we've gotten to this place, but we certainly need to do something fast to get out of it. And again, like I said earlier, I think the war is a world away. You know, there are two competing theories. And one, you could say, hey, President Trump just wanted to remind the Muslims that we will do violence, because there is a doormat Christianity that pervades all of Western society.
True.
And that's part of what we're talking about here, is this doormat Christianity has been crushed under the Supreme Court or the courts down the trough. Yep. Here in this country, it's been crushed by the corporatocracy. Christianity's getting crushed at every angle. So at least the president had the military to send a gut punch and a reminder to the Muslims, hey, we will do violence. We're not just going to sit back and watch this. So there's that theory of the case. And then there's the theory of the case that even if you accept that that is true and maybe necessary, the real crisis of an intifada, of a communist color revolution, of the traitors in the courts or in the Senate or in the House, it's right here at home. I mean, right. the front line, the front wave, first wave of that war is right here in the belly of the beast, Minneapolis, Minnesota, where Ilhan Omar seems all but can't be defeated in her district. Yeah. I mean, that tells you where the fight really is. It's not in Tehran or anywhere in the Middle East.
Yeah, absolutely. I could not agree with you more. Can you stay with us for the whole hour? I wasn't sure if you could keep us. You can? Okay, thank you very much. All right, because I don't want to end right now. There's so much more to get into, because this really does sort of touches everything that we're talking about today. It does have to do with the Iran war and the effects that it's having here, and the effects of Israel and trying to push anti-Semitism bills. I mean, we are very rapidly, literally losing the First Amendment because we're not fighting for it, because we're not standing up for ourselves. And I see sort of a similarity. I always talk about how, you know, the leftist view of race is very sort of a weird inverted white supremacy, where they go, you know, white people are fine. We don't have to protect ourselves. We don't need any, you know, defense. We're white people. We'll be fine. It's like, no, you won't. And it's almost the same with Christianity, where it's just like, we're Christian. We're all Christian. It's fine. It's like, no, you can go away too. You deserve protection too. More with Royce White on the other side. Don't go anywhere, folks. Joined by Royce White. He, of course, hosts the Sunday Night Show here on InfoWars, does an incredible job with that every Sunday evening. You can get to his website by going to RoyceWhite.us. You can follow him on X at Highway_30. We're talking about all sorts of stuff, but sort of centralizing our discussion on the fact that the Bulls NBA team has waived Jaden Ivey after anti-religion LGBTQ rants, is how the New York Post puts it, or as a post-millennial, pro sports players stand up for Jaden Ivey as he's canceled by Chicago Bulls over Christian beliefs. I think that's a more accurate headline. It does feel a little bit different this time, though, doesn't it, Royce? I mean, we've seen this not the first time somebody's been canceled for something like this, but he hasn't apologized. It seems like the outrage I'm seeing is a lot more, and there are a lot of pro athletes, even if they're not coming out blatantly and saying it, they're making social media posts just saying, hey, Jesus is king, you know, and just sort of signaling, hey, I stand with Jaden. Does this feel different to you? Does this signal a shift in the wider consciousness?
I think so. You know, and I think overall your athletes are going to look, a part of this communist color revolution that's not really talked about so much right now is the attempt to take some of the youngest, strongest men in our society, which some of these professional athletes are some of the most incredible human beings to ever live. I mean, in the history of human civilization, some of the things they can do physically and movement-wise is next to supernatural. And there is a sort of cultural effect and intent to take the strongest young men amongst us and neuter them. And emasculate them, you know, and turn them into eunuchs, put them in dresses, and normalize this effeminate, which then becomes homosexual or, in the worst case scenario, transgender mentality. Yeah. And so I think naturally, as we track along here, people got to remember these things happen over long courses of time, or sometimes over a longer course of time. As we track along here, The American professional sports culture, the excellence, the mastery of skill, the hard work and discipline it takes to become a high-level professional athlete is so diametrically opposed to the everybody's equal egalitarianism of the far left. There's naturally going to be a friction and a collision at some point. I just think that this Jaden Ivey story and the Christian piece of it is the fuel is fueling something that's it's a powder keg already, because you can't take men who believe in merit just naturally from their career or their passion, the thing that they're good at. You can't take those men and tell them everybody should be equal, and then tell them, well, you're not equal if you believe in Christ. It's like, what kind of racket is that?
Right.
You know, so I think naturally this thing is going to unravel. The question is, will we be able to hold the country long enough? Will we be able to keep in the fight long enough to take back some of the institutions, right? I mean, that's the whole point of deconstructing administrative state and going against the deep state and shattering the security state and all the things that the MAGA movement said that it was planning to do. And some of them we're doing, some of them we haven't done. I'm in favor. I'm a maximalist. I'm in favor of doing radical things like let's arrest some United States senators and Supreme Court justices. Right. I think President Trump should arrest Chief Justice Roberts. I always hearken people back to Abraham Lincoln suspending habeas corpus and telling Chief Justice Taney, as the rumor goes, told Chief Justice Taney in the United States versus Merriman decision, if you release Merriman or any of these other Confederates, I'm going to arrest you next.
Right.
And he understood the dire nature of the situation. And I don't know that President Trump either does or that the American people have the stomach for him to go maximalist. I know we all say we want that, but I kind of get the sense if he went max, over half, and maybe more than over half of the Republican caucus would sponsor his impeachment papers the next day. You know, if he was to actually arrest John Thune on dereliction of duty charges for withholding secure elections from American citizens, I think your average Republican would say that's a step too far. And I say that for a reason. I use that example to draw back to the NBA. I think a lot of Fox News communists look at professional sports and what happened with Colin Kaepernick, and they're so, and rightfully so, discontent with what's happened to American professional sports, they say, oh, well, this is, you know, this is unacceptable. Well, what if President Trump, you know, put out an executive order and we were going to, you know, bring down the hammer, you know, some harsh penalties or sanctions on some of these companies that were anti-Christian? Would Republicans say that that's an overreach of the executive? And I tend to think that they would. So, you know, it's we find ourselves in a peculiar situation where people know what the problem is, but they don't necessarily want to take the prescription or the cure.
You're exactly right. It's like the biggest issue we have right now is like trying to get through to the Republicans. Like, what do y'all not understand about the condition that America's in, about the seriousness of the problems that we face? And it kind of goes along with, I want to ask the other players on the Bulls, like, why would you not stand up for your teammate? Why would you not, like, I get that it's important that you want to have your million-dollar career and you don't want to cause trouble. I get that would be inconvenient. But, like, do you not get what's at risk here? Do you not understand that, like, each one of these instances is another incremental, you know, it's another bar on the jail cell around us? How do we convey to people the importance of what's going on? We can, you know, I could talk to John, you know, Senator John Thune and try to explain to him, you know, what's happening. At the end of the day, he's just, well, you know, it's just how it is. It's just the way we do it. And it's like, yeah. What do we have to do to get through to some of these people and just and get them to take the necessary measures?
Yeah, you got to start arresting some people. That's for sure.
Be a good place to start.
It'd be a good place to start. Yeah, and again, even from a cultural standpoint, when you talk about the makeup of an NBA team, half of those players on each team don't believe in God in the first place. Mm. I mean, or they only casually or loosely believe in God, much like a lot of the 501c3 Christians all across our great nation here. We don't live in a Christian nation. We live in a nation that should be Christian, that was intended to be predominantly Christian, but we're so far from that, it's almost laughable at this point, right? Because if you're a Christian nation, you don't let communists and Satanists and pedophiles take over just from the outset. I mean, that would be a non-starter. It isn't a non-starter. But half of those players on those teams don't even believe in God. The other half are frightened to lose financial security in what is a very financially insecure environment nationwide. I mean, we have real financial insecurity that's widespread. So, I mean, imagine you're accustomed to the high life. You don't want to lose that. And this goes to a much deeper issue of radical materialism and communism and Marxism and the reduction of the human existence down to price.
Yep.
And we have to understand, all of us, and even President Trump. That's why I don't like when he says, oh, me and President Xi have a good relationship. No, you don't. He wants to kill you. Because, again, if Iran is being subsidized by China in an Iron Triangle alliance and the Iranians sanctioned a hit on the president, that would mean China sanctioned a hit on the president. So he's not your friend. But what we can definitively say about China is that they are a nation led by tyrannical and authoritarian engineers. We are a nation that wanted to be a nation of ideas and laws. So naturally, we're a nation led by lawyers. When you put tyrannical engineers versus crony capitalist lawyers, the tyrannical engineers win 9 times out of 10. And so the question we have to ask ourselves is there any scenario where a nation ruled by lawyers, in general, lawyers, can beat a nation ruled by tyrannical engineers? I think the answer is yes, but the premium on the rule of law and the integrity of the institutions that uphold the rule of law has to be almost unimpeachable, unassailable. And we're so far from that. It's that in and of itself is almost a concession to our defeat by the Chinese, because we don't, I mean, we're inverted. We think of the law as something that should, you know, almost axiomatically be corrupt. Like, yeah, well, it's the law. Of course, it's pay to play. I mean, if you can't afford a good lawyer, of course the judge is going to slap you, hit you with the book. Alex Jones in a civil case where you owe $1 billion. I mean, this thing is, I thought it was out of control then. Right. When Alex Jones was sued and they awarded $1 billion, I said, oh, tyranny. Right. And people kind of looked at it, even on the right, and said, well, yeah, Alex Jones deserved it. He shouldn't have been running his mouth like that. Well, now you get a Christian, young Christian man who says, hey, the LGBTQ is a little unrighteous. And the NBA drops, throws the book at him, you know, metaphorically. And then the same conservatives who okayed Alex Jones being sued into oblivion are now mad that the Christian can't say what he wants. What don't you people get? They're all connected.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all connected to the same communist color revolution.
Yeah, that has to hollow out our country, has to undermine our foundational beliefs. And they often do it by sort of using our own beliefs against us. And I mean, this is something I say all the time, is like, you're not a good person for being taken advantage of. People really think that it's like mean to defend yourself. It's mean to lay down the law. It's like, no, mercy to the guilty is violence to the innocent, right? You have to be hardcore about this stuff. And you're right. I don't understand how we've gone so far off the mark. And it seems like, especially, I mean, even like when arguing with the leftists, it's like, all right, you like all these things like welfare and the you know, government money coming to you. Shouldn't they be the ones who are concerned about the fraud? They don't care about the fraud for some reason. It's like, we have to have more hardcore laws here. We have to have people stick to it. The judges won't convict anybody. Somebody just stole, you know, tens of millions of dollars. This woman, Zamzam, her name is Zamzam. She was just convicted. I think $40 million, if I'm not mistaken, that she stole. She was asked to pay back less than $500,000. She'll spend 6 months in prison. By August this year, she'll be back in Somalia with tens of millions of stolen dollars. And it's like, that's the justice system. Meanwhile, I'm sure you've heard the story, a guy's facing 10 years for cheating in a fishing tournament. It's like everything has gone off the rails, Royce. Like, yes. How? And the problem is that our system is so broken now, it's opening up an opportunity for the communists, for the radicals, for the revolutionaries to come in and go, this system's messed up. You need us. You need our new amazing system that I promise is going to make everything right. How do we fix the system while still trying to uphold the system? We don't want to tear it down. We want to fix. It's a complicated issue. How do we approach this?
I think the reason why people are willing to put up with it is because they enjoy the benefits. As I said about the Somali community, I did this PBS Frontline interview, and I said people crave tyranny. And the interviewer at the time, I know him, been knowing him for many years now. He works for PBS, or he's an independent contractor. Anyway, he's like, well, I don't want tyranny. I don't want to live under a tyrant. I go, yeah, so you say. I mean, Aristotle's Fifth Book of Politics tells us that women and slaves love tyrants. We got a lot of women running this country, but we also have a lot of slaves, debt slaves, wage slaves, right? So, I mean, I think the dark truth is people crave tyranny because it's convenient. And
it's easy.
It's easy, yeah. And, we take the benefits. It's like the Somali community, for example. Oh, ICE is terrorizing us. Oh, the federal government's overreaching. This is tyranny. Well, you accept the subsidies. You can't have... You can't have it both ways. You can't have a government that's inflated well beyond its rightful size and think that tyranny isn't going to – you're not going to feel the sting of tyranny and then say, oh, well, but it's okay because I still get my social programs. And that's the left right now. Of course they don't. They don't care if Somalis – because we're printing more money. As long as they get their SNAP benefits – they don't care if, and this is the danger. This is what they would call in the financial sector moral hazard, right? The sort of subtle unintended consequences of certain financial instruments and mechanisms. Like, if you're going to print money and there's no penalty, no real penalty or consequences for stealing money or losing money, Department of Defense, hey, we lost another $2 trillion. What the hell? Doesn't matter. If there's no consequences, as I've said for many years, even when I was back on Jason Whitlock's show, when your government steals, everybody steals. See, right. This is how the Republicans really get us, though. They want our political identity to be attached to the cultural wedge issues just as much as the left, because it's easy for them to control the narrative around cultural wedge issues. Even the LGBTQ, women playing in men's sports. My Senate opponent, Michelle Tafoya, her whole campaign is, we got to get men out of women's sports. It's like, you want to be United States centered. And I get that's ridiculous and an abomination that we've allowed that to happen. But talk to me about monetary policy.
Right.
Talk to me about foreign policy. Talk to me about legacy institutions that have generations of corruption throughout. Don't talk to me about a couple of weird tranny dudes and, you know, playing in sports. That goes without saying, right? Or it should. But, you know, it's the Fox News MO is, pay attention to the young black men who are, snatching bags out of department stores. It's like, well, you know, you could take every black person in America and add up all the merchandise they've stolen for the last 100 years, and it wouldn't be a drop in the bucket for $2 trillion that the Department of Defense just misplaced,
yeah.
Right? And it's like, well, those two things aren't connected. It's like, oh, really, Mark Levin? They're not connected? Oh, sure. Sure, buddy. You know, let's just go by the quantitative measure. The more money you steal, the greater penalty. You know, there shouldn't be a reprieve for stealing more money. It's like the difference between white-collar crime and blue-collar crime. It's like, right. Well, you know, they only stole money in the stock exchange. It's like, well, that has a real-world effect on people. Like, where are we getting off letting these white-collar, cosmopolitan, omnisexual globalists get away with this financial racket?
Yep.
Racketeering is what it is. Through our own military-industrial complex, we pay for it. But, you know, people have to wake up and get wise to that. And if they did, you'd never vote for a Gavin Newsom again.
Yep.
Like, oh, I revere Israel. It's like, no, fuck off, buddy. You know, what a jerk off, right? I mean, it's all of them, right? It's all of them. But then it's so bad, even Massey. And I've asked this question a number of times. Maybe you can help me out with the thinking. See, even Massey, who I like and I agree with a lot, and you know, it's just like, well, the Congress is captured, 95% captured. But then you want the president to come to the Congress and ask them for permission to do anything. It's like, wouldn't that be a concession to the capture? And I get it. It's like, well, we got to follow the rules. It's like, no, you guys didn't play sports. When a scuffle breaks out in the middle of a game, there are no more rules.
Yep.
There are no more. When I get hit with that bean pitch and I storm the mound, we're emptying these dugouts. And the only way we go back to the rules is if both teams say, we've had enough. We want to return back to the rules. Then you can go back to the previous rules. But until then, the rules are effectively suspended. This is a knock. This is a blood sport now in basketball, and don't even talk about MMA. But, you know, that's kind of my mentality, is like, there's a suspension of the rules. The left suspended them. The communists suspended them. The globalists suspended them. The only one playing by the rules are the doormat Christians and the conservatives.
And they're doing it themselves. Like, we're doing it ourselves. We're enforcing it on ourselves. And I think you're exactly right, because our whole system depends on precedent, right? And this is always the excuse from the Republicans as well. We can't do that because what if they come back and do it to us? That doesn't work when the left routinely does things that are unprecedented, routinely does things that have no precedent at all in law or justice or morality or anything. And then Republicans refuse to return the favor because, you know, like you said, like, when, you know, once the scuffle breaks out, you know, it's all bets are off, clear the dugouts, let's go. But even in smaller ways, it's like if you're playing on team and they go, oh, well, we don't play that. We don't play offsides. We don't play whatever it is. You know, we do a change rule. And it's like, okay, that's the new rule. Now you have to play by that. So, okay, if they want to throw people in jail for January 6th, I guess that's the new rule. I guess we have to play by that. And that actually is the reason why, you know, the precedent setting works, is because we need Democrats to go, ooh, if we do that, they're going to do it to us. But they know we're not going to do it to them, so they can do whatever the hell they want. And Republicans will sit there following the rules that are no longer valid.
Yes. No, that's 100% right. And we just don't. We just got to get some toughness and grit. I said it the other day about when I did the show on Sunday about the 1776 mantra so oftenly invoked by conservatives. And it's like, well, you know, what about law enforcement? I mean, we have a default position on the right that comes from the conservative Fox News communists that says anything a cop tells you to do ever, you should just listen. You should obey. It's like, excuse me? What did you just say? What if they tell me I have to take a vaccine or provide my vaccine mandate papers? Do I still have to obey and listen? Oh, well, that wouldn't happen. Oh, really? Mark Levin, you're vaccinated, buddy. I mean, and we know it. So, and I don't mean to keep picking on him, but he has become, you know, sort of the titular head of Conservative Inc. and the messaging and narrative. And it's just like, where do these people get off with these type of brazen contradictions? Their logic is so flawed. And the fact that people are even willing to listen to them, let alone follow them, is a sign of a decadent culture. But I hope we could turn it around. You can't preclude miracles, especially during Holy Week, right? Mm. Christ is risen, and miracles are possible. So we could turn it around, but we need some hellacious fighters right now to step up and just say things like you are. If you support the war in Israel, you're a communist. Why? Socialism and communism are only a degree away, and we're socializing the risk of our phony money in order to fund the war. So you're just as much of a socialist as the Somalis who stole a state taxpayer money.
Yep. And or just stand on the First Amendment and go, sorry, you don't have a right to tell me what I can and can't say. I don't care if you think it's hateful. I don't care if you think it's anti-Semitic. I get to say what I want. And actually, it's those things that are hateful or anti-Semitic or whatever. That is literally the reason the First Amendment was written. Obviously, it is the thing that gives Jews the right to practice their religion and Catholics the right to practice their religion. It also incumbent in that right is the right for everybody else to criticize, mock, denigrate. It doesn't matter. It's the same rule that gives both of these rights to the American people. And that is where the biggest threat is coming from, as far as I can see it. The push for anti-Semitism, anti-Semitism laws, and the hatred of Christianity and the discrimination against Christians. I mean, this is a major problem that we have to identify and fight against. What's the best way to do that, do you think?
Well, I think we're at a point now where we can't rely on the Supreme Court or any other courts to adjudicate that type of justice or fairness interpretation of the laws that we already have. A commander in chief, a warrior philosopher is going to have to take power in this country at some point and bring down the hammer. Now, I'm not ever for rounding people up and having, kangaroo witch hunt, lawfare or weaponized courts. But, some of these things are sort of explicitly anti-Christian, anti-American, anti-human.
Yep.
So, like, look at what happened in Spain. Euthanasia. I mean, where are we headed? We know where we're headed. We're looking at the inevitability of what we will become when we see a euthanization carried out on a 24-year-old young, healthy bodied, abled woman in Spain, in Europe. And then we're paying to subsidize their territorial integrity. It's like at the moment where they lose the sanctity of life, we should be pulling out of NATO. Mm-hmm. And that should just be a matter of principle and morality. But we don't have that moral structure. Okay, fine. If the rules are there are no morals, then let's just call it that. Let's just say that. I mean, but let's not say we're going to fight a war for Israel on behalf of Christianity and our morals. It's like, no, you're not.
No. Yeah.
I mean, who do you think you're? Come on. Don't even say that. Like, I'd rather you just come out and say, we don't give a damn about the morals or the ethics. There are no rules. There are no morals. We're going to win the Darwinian game, and that's just the way we're playing it. Okay, now we can have a better conversation. But when you undermine the Christian ethic at a fundamental level, you have abnegated your legitimacy to say that it's in a pursuit of a Christian formulation of thought or culture. That's just blasphemy, is what it is in Holy Week here. That, my friends, is blasphemy.
And we see it everywhere. It's absolutely constant and ridiculous. Just incredible stuff. Royce White is my guest. RoyceWhite.us is the website. @Highway_30 on X. And, of course, you're running for Senate. How can people help you with that? Any events coming up? Anything you need people to know about your campaign?
Yes, U.S. Senate. I'm running for U.S. Senate again. Tina Smith, open seat. Running hopefully against a Democrat, Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan. Protect trans rights with the knife. Angie Craig. $3 million from AIPAC. On my side, you got Michelle Tafoya, pro-choice, pro-Zionist, and you got Adam Schwarzy, 20-year naval vet, recently the CIA, pro-life, pro-Zionist. I mean, they're trying to pincer me at every angle here.
Right, they got you at every corner.
But hey, I'm just a dumb black Negro from the neighborhood, and I'm America first, so I guess that makes me persona non grata. And I wear it as a badge of honor. Come see me and Mike Lindell at Wayzata Middle School if you're in Minnesota on April 8th.
Well, we need more people like you in the government, man. We wouldn't be in this situation in the first place if we had more. RoyceWhite.us @Highway_30 on X. Thank you so much for being here with us, sir. It's very, very interesting times we live in, and the cultural landscape is shifting underneath us. I do want to remind you to go to thealexjonesstore.com to support everything that we do here. We're running out of Faraday bags, so get yours while you still can. Stay tuned. I'll be joined very shortly by Tiffany Cianci with some breaking news about pesticide law that nobody else has. This is an exclusive coming up. Donald Trump is live right now taking questions about the conflict, so we're going to go to that live for the first 5 minutes, and then we'll be joined by Kelsey Sheeran at 6 after. But let's go to Donald Trump now live taking questions on the Iran conflict.
And they wanted it protected. Granted, it's pretty good, but they wanted it protected by a lot deeper. They wanted to go a lot deeper, and they started the process. while rapidly building conventional ballistic missiles. They were going to do it all at the same time. It threatened our overseas bases and soon could have reached even our homeland. The regime's intention was to use this exponentially growing ballistic missile threat to make it virtually impossible to prevent them from obtaining a nuclear weapon. So as you probably saw, they had a tremendous number of missiles, most of which had now been used or destroyed, and very unsuccessfully used, because we have been able, for the most part, to shoot them all down. What incredible technology. The Patriots have been unbelievable, and other things. And the laser technology that we have now is incredible. It's coming out pretty soon. We're literally lasers will do the work of, at a lot less cost, do the work of what the Patriots are doing or what other things are doing. The situation was very quickly approaching the point of no return, and the United States found it intolerable, in my opinion, based on what Steve and Jared and Pete and others were telling me, Marco, so involved, that I thought that they were going to attack us. I thought they would, if we didn't do this at the time we did it, I think they had in mind to attack us. And if you notice, they did something which was very foolish, very stupid, I would say. They attacked their neighbors. And their neighbors were largely neutral, or at least weren't going to be involved, and they got attacked. And it had the reverse effect. The neighbors came onto our side and started attacking them, and actually quite successfully. If you look at Saudi Arabia, you look at UAE, Qatar, and others, but they were strong and they were smart, but they got attacked. Nobody, when I first heard it, I said, no, somebody made a mistake. There was no mistake. UAE had over 1,000 missiles shot at it, knocked them almost all down. On the very first day I came down the escalator in 2015, I said, quote, I will stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons. And all I'm doing is keeping my promise. Think of that. That was in 2015. I said it. It was a threat then and a much bigger threat now, but no longer a threat, not for a long time anyway. We want to keep it that way. As we continue Operation Epic Fury, we're also focused on keeping energy and oil flowing to the world. And I will not allow a terrorist regime to hold the world hostage and attempt to stop the globe's oil supply. And if Iran does anything to do that, they'll get hit at a much, much harder level. I will take out those targets that were easy and that I mentioned just before. We'll take them out so quickly, they'll never be able to recover, ever. If they want to play that game, they better not play that game. In the long run, oil supplies will be dramatically more secure without the threat of Iranian ships, drones, missiles, nuclear menace, or anything. So the Strait of Hormuz is going to remain safe. We have a lot of Navy ships there. We have the best equipment in the world, inspecting for mines. Again, most of their ships are down at the bottom of the sea. But we will hit them so hard that it will not be possible for them or anybody else helping them to ever recover that section of the world, if they do anything. In recent years, the regime and its terror proxies have launched attacks on hundreds of commercial vessels. We're putting an end to all of this threat once and for all, and the result will be lower oil prices, oil and gas prices for American families. We've done that. We've done it. We brought it very low. This was just an excursion into something that had to be done. We're getting very close to finishing that, too. In the meantime, during this brief disruption, the United States is offering political risk insurance to any tankers operating in the Gulf. So we're putting up risk insurance.
All right, folks, that's Trump with a live address. We'll be back on the other side with Kelsey Sheeran in studio. Don't go anywhere. I'm joined in studio by Kelsey Sheeran. She's a combat veteran, mental performance coach, and independent journalist. She's the host of the Kelsey Sheeran Perspective, a best-selling author and a leading voice in the movement opposing Canada's MAID expansion, medical assistance in dying, aka medical suicide. You can follow her Substack at Kelsey Sheeran and on X at Kelsey Burns. That's K-E-L-S-I Burns on X. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me. I fixed the X thing, by the way. Somebody taught me how I could actually change it. So just Kelsey Sharon now. So I fixed
it. Oh, so it's just Kelsey Sharon.
I fixed it now. I'm so grateful I could figure that out finally. So okay. Don't mind me.
But so on X at Kelsey Sharon.
There it is.
KelseSharen.
Nailed it.
There you go.
Nailed it.
So, let's get into Mage, shall we? I mean, it is insane. You were here not that long ago, but even in the time between now and then, so much has developed. What is the latest with the drive to kill everybody in Canada?
Well, it's not. That's the worst part. Everybody says Kelsey opposes MAID in Canada. I oppose MAID across the globe and in America's 13 states and one jurisdiction for 14 total. You guys are doing it too.
Right.
So, you know, I think the where we're at right now since I've been on, I know I've been on a few times since December, and I'm so grateful for the opportunity to talk about it. So thank you. Is that we now have found so many really disgusting motives in America that are quite shocking to me. And I'm still waiting for RFK or Donald Trump to kind of step in and say, guys, we have to stop this, because just the same way that Canada slow rolled the program and allowed the ideology of the pro-death cult through dying with dignity to kind of come in the 90s and usher into our government, you guys have your own death group called Compassion and Choices. Isn't that a great name? So Compassion and Choices is an organization that is a nonprofit charity. It's under your 5-0. And these are people who spend every waking minute of their life congregating to the tune of $33 to $35 million is what their current asset sits are. And what they do is they go and partner with people like the Rabin Group. Do you know who the Rabin Group is?
No.
Oh, you're going to love these.
I feel like
guys.
I should.
I feel like you should. I feel like all of America should. So let me tell you about them, because we recently discovered their plans until 2028 for America. And so Compassion and Choices has now partnered again, $30 million organization.
Crazy.
And hired the Rabin Group. Now, this is a social cohesion. You know, these are the people that are responsible for your big protests. They work with, and they boast who they work with. So they've worked with the Obama Foundation, the Bill Gates Foundation, and there's a long laundry list. But ironically, Compassion and Choices isn't on their client list. But what they have stated in their own, this is what's crazy, it's on YouTube. It's on YouTube. They talk about their plans, and what they are expecting to do over the next few years in America is expand MAID to over 50% of where the American population lives so that they can have access to MAID. So we talked about the states with you guys before, but it's important to know what they are again so that you can protect your loved ones, because, you know, the Rabin Group has made it very clear their incentive in this call working alongside them is to change social cohesion so that places that don't necessarily have legislation on the table can actually start to slow roll and target their community members to be comfortable with the idea of euthanasia, right, and physician assisted suicide, which is what America does. And that's just for track one. And they're targeting these areas of a high elderly density population. So the current states, I've said this before, I know you guys have heard it, but go with me. The current states right now, yeah, that's their lovely website, guys. So they have 13 states, one jurisdiction, so 14 total. So Michael Malice has been doing an incredible job. He actually just named my new book because he's brilliant, and he calls it Killing Grandma, so thank you to him. He went on Rogan talking about these states for me because he said, look, everyone wants to bang on about Canada, but Kelsey's right. America is doing this, and it's slow rolling it as a form of healthcare. So currently California, Colorado, Delaware, Hawaii, Illinois, Maine, Montana, New Jersey, New Mexico, New York is your newest, Oregon and Vermont, Washington and Washington, D.C. Now, the reason it's important to note about these is because Oregon and Vermont do not have a residency requirement.
Oh.
So anyone in America, say you're from Texas, say you've become compassionate toward the idea of euthanizing your grandma, you can take a one-way flight to Oregon or Vermont and get qualified by two very sick MAID assessors who get paid an ungodly amount of money to say that you're okay to die. And then they'll set a cup in front of grandma and grandma drinks the poison. So that's what's crazy about that. Now, the point that we should be paying attention to, because there is actual legislation on the table in America right now, and they have plans, and I quote, this is right from Compassion and Choices, by 2028, half of the U.S. adult population will live where medical aid in dying is accessible. And they politically planned legislative campaigns for 18 states in 2016. and in key states such as Nevada, Virginia, and Florida. Even though Florida doesn't have legislation yet, the current ones that do have legislation on the table, this is crazy to me, Virginia, Tennessee, Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, Missouri, Minnesota, Mass, Kentucky, Iowa, Arizona, and India. Now tell me, friend, what do they all have in common in those areas, potentially?
Oh, good question. Well, a lot of retirees.
Ah, we're nailing it.
Yes.
And they're only targeting track one, which is all your terminally ill or elderly population. So, you know, I just had this conversation with Constantine Kissin and Francis Foster like an hour ago. And there was one point that was really good to illustrate was, much like the trans movement towards children and mutilating children, they start here, right? They start targeting kids and going up. And what these death cults do is they target top down. So if you can convince grandma that she should end her life, now what's going to happen is you have all of the elderly in that family and family members and children all going, well, grandma did it. So it's okay then when mom needs it. So it's okay then when we go to mature minors. It's, you see what I'm saying? So trans went up, we're going down, and we're meeting in the middle. Now, Canada itself, we are about to, and I think people have seen this now, it went viral the past couple of weeks. I'm so grateful. Zuby, I went on Zuby's podcast and we discussed it. Canada is about to cross the 100,000th murder in less than 10 years. We're estimating between April and June of when that target's going to hit. And then after that, we're expecting 110,000 deaths by the calendar end of 2026. Now, that is without expanding to the mentally ill. Mental illness comes on the table March of 2027. Wow. So we are expecting a rapid uptick in 2027. And then the parliamentary AbMed report, this is important to note for people who have children in Canada. AbMed report was done by the Parliamentary of Canada where they looked at mature minors, they looked at mate expansion. And in Canada, we don't have parent consent, meaning like our government can take our kids.
Right.
Like it's pretty clear. Everyone knows that. So a group of cardio moms reached out to me from Sick Kids Children's Hospital. I've been involved with Sick Kids before because there's an individual named Adam there. We call him Adam R. We don't say his last name. I don't want to be sued, even though he's quite public about it. He's the head of the PICU team for a lot of these children's families. And Adam was the head of a friend of mine's daughter's PICU team, Vea, and she was moved out of the hospital for a reason. He advocates on the board of CanMap, which is the people who train all the doctors to kill people. And he's advocating for mature minors while running and participating at one of the largest children's hospitals. Now, that's important because the AbMed report stated very clearly that the government of Canada establishes a requirement where appropriate, the parents and guardians of a mature minor, which is down to age of 12, by the way.
Yep.
And that's also where you ironically lose consent to your children's medical decision making and access to files, also at 12. No coincidence there. The mature minor may be consulted in the course of an assessment process for MAID, but the will of the minor who is found to have the requisite decision making capacity ultimately will take priority. Parents and guardians may or may not be even consulted.
It sounds too bad to be true, right? Because what you're describing is like, as parents, one day you get a letter from the hospital saying your kid came to us, said they were sad, and we killed them. Like, that's what it's, I mean, it's like too horrible to believe. But I don't think I'm misunderstanding that.
No, you're not. So this, the reason I bring papers with me, I know so many shows I hate when I do it, but I do it because the stuff that we're talking about is not an off-the-cuff opinion.
Right.
It is not me making something up to be emotive or get clicks or do any of those things. It's very clearly stated in our own parliamentary reports and our own documentation and paperwork. So it's always best when I read directly from what the government is saying, so I cannot be taken out of context. Very clearly, Sick Kids removes consent. Majority of hospitals remove consent at 12 years old and access to your child's medical records. Period, full stop, have proof of it, posted it. The AbMed report itself is very clear. That means in 2023, and before that, they were already discussing adding children. So when people like Dying with Dignity or Compassion and Choices and the government argues, this is just for grandma. This is just for grandma. Yeah, that's one of those pamphlets we found. And it's not. It's never been just for grandma. And you even have senators, your own state senators, stating, we just need to get this legalized here and we will expand and amend as we go.
Right.
So they've told us their plan. They've made it very clear. But there is hope in Alberta. So this is about to come out. It's not out yet. But I have been told I can discuss it. The Alberta government reached out to me and said, hey, we're about to do something. Can you just kind of give people a heads up? So Alberta is going to be putting a bill forward and trying to stop Track 2 in their province.
Oh, good.
So Track 2 is your non-foreseeable death. That is your mature minors. That is your mentally ill. That is basically we just kill grandma there.
Okay.
I'm still not okay with it.
Right.
But here's what I've had to come to grips with is you cannot stop a bullet train. You have to slow it first.
Mm.
So I am optimistic that where we are going with this is that there will be a province that potentially has its head on straight and that I'm hoping other provinces will follow suit because right now it goes Quebec, Ontario, and British Columbia, and that is where we kill the majority of the citizens that are being poisoned to death by their doctors. Now, it's important to also state that like where we're at right now, I found something that was, you think that I come on with positive news, but I I found something that was really gross 2 days ago when prepping to come down here. And I found out the billing codes that doctors and assessors and how much per billing code per patient they're allowed to use and what they make on average. Is that something you would like to do?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's the hell they get $100,000 for vaccinating enough people. So, yeah. Their incentive structure is not always the most pleasant thing to read. So this is the like a doctor in Canada performs MAID and this is how they bill it to the insurance company or I guess
Canada
since
Canada.
It's all okay. So, so this is the code that they use to bill for MAID.
Yeah, so how it works, right, is you need two MAID assessors, which are different, hypothetically different people.
Okay.
And so each one that they can bill for that situation, which, by the way, Canada now in the last 2024 report states that we have 2,266 MAID killers in the country. And by the way, they won't put them all on a list because they know I'll find it.
Right.
They will not list these people. You have to independently find them. So I'm working on that right now. But roughly out of the all of those doctors doing MAID, 350 are doing the majority of the 100,000 deaths that have happened. Well, if you're doing an average, okay, say there's 55% of these three doing all of these deaths, follow the math with me. That's like an average of like 214 kills each. Okay, that's 214. And the FBI defines a serial killer right. as two or more, right? Okay. Now, if you're, say you're doing that, you got 100,000, 55% of these 100,000 deaths are performed by 350 physicians. Well, that's, you know, 55,000 procedures. Even if you break it down further and say they only kill 157 people. Well, you know, you can charge about $1,800 to $1,000, right? Because an assessment is, you know, roughly $300. And then a MAID procedure is between, you know, $300 to $500, depending on your qualifications. So on average, it's about, you know, $800, $826 if you do one assessment and one procedure and one set of drugs. Not both assessments, but that's if you do one, and one. The drugs are 147. The average person somebody could make for murdering 157 Canadian souls is $161,710 a year. So six figures. And then you have Ellen Weeb, who admits to over 1,000 deaths, and that's roughly over $800,000. And don't worry, she's been doing abortions for 40 years prior to that.
Right.
And an abortion in Canada is between $200 and $400.
That's wild.
And that's what you bill. So the reason that's important, guys, is because this is not just a moral issue, which we already all struggle with, or if you have a mind, you do. But this is now a financially incentive. Forget what the government's right. going to save. Now, what are the doctors actually making their practices on? And then the Keanu story we spoke about last time I was here, you know, the 26-year-old that kind of went viral. And, you know, I spoke more to Margaret about it, his mom, and I said, like, do you have the receipts of the drugs? She goes, yeah, because when he flew to British Columbia, he had to go pick up and buy his own drugs.
Oh, wow.
And then I decided to be cheeky. I was curious. I knew he was MAID in a funeral home. He wasn't MAID in a hospital or in a care facility. He drove himself to a funeral home. So I made a video calling that funeral home. And within 2 minutes, I found out how easy it was to be killed for roughly $300 to $500 at a funeral home, and the doctor will meet you there when you bring your own drugs. And they can even, my friend, they can even handle the cremation there too. So
one-stop shop.
It's a one-stop shop. And so, like, look, I said this earlier today. We can have the moral conversation of, can a society handle a program like this? Canada has proved we cannot.
Right.
So then why is the American government, and which, by the way, let me be very clear, husband's American, love America, served with America. I would like to live in America.
Right.
But why, guys, why are we at a point where a Canadian podcaster has to sound an alarm so loud and you're still not paying attention? Because Gavin Newsom, which I'm sure everyone in this building loves, Gavin Newsom just recently admitted that he was a participant in illegally mating his own mother in 2002.
Really? I did not know that.
Nobody knows that, even though he wrote about it in his own memoir, and it's also been reported by the Washington Post.
And of course, California is where they're already setting the table for 12-year-olds are in charge of their own medical.
Right. So, but here's the thing with that, though, right? You have a governor who actually said himself, in his own words, I hate her for making me participate in that because it was so traumatic.
Right.
But then he rolls the program into California in 2015 and 2016. So what's the incentive if you've participated in, again, it was not legal till 2015, 2016, and in 2002, he participated in mating his own mom. There it is. God, whoa. I love you guys.
I hated her for it. That's wild.
Right. But why? This is February this year. Why am I the only one talking about this?
Yeah, that's insane. Well, and actually, that was my next question, was like, what is the motivation? Because I can understand being against this and wanting to put your full, you know, like you are, just like dedicating your life to fighting this because it's
sorry.
So evil. But it's like, who is paying tens of millions of dollars? But who is driven to push this? Who is like taking this on as a righteous cause? Like, what is the incentive for that? That's wild.
Listen, again, it goes back to the spiritual warfare thing in a real way. So we don't have to get conspiratorial. We don't even have to be conspiratorial about it. You know, you've got the eugenic side of things, which we already knew failed miserably. And now Canada is about to hit numbers bigger than World War II.
Right.
You know, forget the Holocaust. People came at me, they said, well, you're comparing it to the Holocaust. I said, in no way am I comparing this to the Holocaust. I'm comparing it to the eugenics program that was utilized to kill 200,000 German, by Germans, mentally ill and disabled people.
Yeah.
And Canada has now hit the 100,000th. We're about to, correction. So if we can't see the correlation here and we cannot learn from history and we cannot understand that there is a financial incentive by the government to save money, there is a financial incentive by the pharmaceutical companies to provide the poison, and there is a financial incentive by the doctors to change all of their practices to easily billable. You know what? I know a doctor who does 4 to 6 a day.
Oof.
So think, dude, that's stripper money.
That's wild.
But think about the amount. Think about that. $800 on average a patient. You pop a few of those a day. And you do that every day, 5 days a week.
I could do it for less than that.
I know, right? Well, we all could. But
not to make light of it, but it's
no,
like
but
they are literally killing. They are literally people are coming in. They're killing them.
Yes.
They're getting a check. And
yes.
Then they go home at night. And that's they're just like, I'm a doctor. And, like, what?
And they go on vacation. Crazy. They take their kids to Disneyland. They, you know, and this is my point is like, forget the money. Forget the money. We're doing the same approach we allowed. I'm just early to it. So it sounds crazy. This is why when people say, but Kelsey, it's just for grandma. And I said this to Constantine too. He goes, do you think there's a world? I said, that's what palliative care and hospice are supposed to be for.
Right.
But we're defunding those.
Right.
So is it free will if CanMap, who teaches the doctors how to kill people, has sold a protocol to Health Canada, which by the way, they did, and is a charity, but doesn't let us see the IP in which they're teaching them.
Mm.
So is it free will and free understanding and consent if we don't know actually what's being taught to the doctors, how they're feeding information, how they're utilizing it as a tool? And then why are we so okay with all of a sudden our organ donations skyrocketing through the roof?
I was going to mention that too. That's because that's another money aspect as well.
Oh my gosh. And that's what we're seeing because even after you use the drugs, right? Even if you're mated outside. So I'm going to start calling it what it is. Even if you've been medically murdered outside of the hospital and it's been done at home in a peaceful way where all of your grandkids watch, which is sick. If they move you quickly enough, they can grab the organs still.
Right.
If not, they're done in the hospital and then they wait for the time of death and then they wheel you in and they cut you open and take you for parts.
it's sad that I'm like trying to think of like, well, what if we ban, you know, organ harvesting? Then it's like, we shouldn't even be negotiating this. Like, we got to put a hard stop to this and just roll it. Not even a hard stop. We have to roll this back. Where it's been introduced, it has to be repealed.
Well, and so that's my point of why I'm so damn grateful for this platform. I get so much crap for coming on here, but I'm telling you, I'm so grateful for InfoWars and for you guys, because it shouldn't take some Canadian veteran who's just found something that makes me severely uncomfortable to come down and say, you guys are walking into a death trap. And I am praying one day we get a phone call that says, come educate these people really quickly, because if not, 18 more states. And here's, once these laws are in, you know how hard it is to repeal a law and bring it back and pull it back. But you have a chance. You guys have how many? 51?
50 states.
You have 50 states. Sorry.
So far.
Because you have districts too. So sometimes I get a little
wonky. And Greenland will be added soon.
I can't wait. Can you add us? Can I come?
Yeah, that actually might be happening.
I mean, I would love that. I would super love some form of political asylum, and I would move in a heartbeat. But
we have much more than half the states don't have this yet.
Not yet.
Yeah.
This is my point is, yes, I'm early and I sound crazy to the listeners, but I promise you, if I come and say something, I have the data, the reports, the proof, the evidence that this will not stop at killing grandma.
Yeah.
This will go to what we are discussing, which is mental illness alone in March of 2027, and mature minors, which are babies and children. And the College of Physicians has stated we should start euthanizing 0 to 1 for major mental, major illnesses, so they have a good quality of life.
Yep. Yep. No, and that's another one of the stories that broke in between the last time you were here. And we're gonna get a bunch of things. I've just been thinking about them as we've been talking. We'll print them out during the break.
Yeah.
Because that's just one of them. Yeah, literally assisted suiciding babies. And again, the people that are pushing this, inexplicable though it may be, they are like dedicated to this. They are pushing it hard. If they can't get it through this bill, they'll put it in the next one. They're lobbying for this. They are in your state house right now trying to slow roll this and convince your authorities to at least let them get the foot in the door, because after that, you know, they get free run. So it's up to us, and it's up to people like my guest, Kelsey Sheeran, to be the opposition force, to go into the state house and lay out the facts for the legislatures. More on the other side. Don't go anywhere. Probably one of the only outlets covering what is just a jaw-dropping story. Well, just a series of jaw-dropping stories about MAID, medical assistance in dying in Canada, coming here, and the really long overdue mission to stop it from coming here. Kelsey Sheeran is helping to lead that fight. You can find her on X at Kelsey Sheeran. That's KelseSheeren. She's also on Substack. Just search her name there. We're just looking up some of the stories in the break here. Canada may start euthanizing babies. That's the headline from lifenews.com. And like, it makes sense. So the people trying to push this here, they know that if you start with this, it's not going to fly. You can't start with, we're going to kill babies in the infirm. You have to start with, we're going to let grandma pass in the way that she wants. But obviously that's a strategy. And it's like offensive that they would state that that's their strategy, because they just know. They know what they're doing is evil. They know people wouldn't accept it. They know they have to boil them like a frog in water slowly over time until they have us in their grasp. It is so deceitful and subversive. It's evil.
Yeah,
in so many ways.
It's not a shock at this point, right? Because when the enemy shows you who they are, you have to believe them the first time. It's kind of like the same sort of, you know, idea around radical Islam and what we've seen now, right? I said this from overseas when I came home and people are like, well, you're awfully racist. I said, no, when the enemy shows you who you are, believe them the first time. You shouldn't have to keep learning. And so this is where we're at, right? So like I said to you before the break, when you have the trans ideology come up and get children, it's only natural we start now going top down and we meet in the middle at 12. And so it's not a coincidence that now we're talking about this. I mean, this has been discussed before, but it had been brought up again. That's Dying with Dignity's lovely children's book there.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have brought it up before, where they said, you know, look, we are going to be naturally moving this in a direction where people are going to be wanting this. And I said, well, I don't think that's the truth. I don't think people want to euthanize their babies, but turns out no different than people wanting to transition their children. It's an ideology. It's a cult mindset. It's a, I want to be a part of that. And then you have things like Munchausen by proxy and really looking at how do people fit in. And from a society's perspective, I get it. Nobody wants to see a child suffer. But when you have the College of Physicians from Quebec stating this, that we should start having discussion around euthanizing children from 0 to 1, they're not talking about, you know, healthy children. They're actually saying, well, what if they're born with something like spinal bifida?
Right.
You know, their quality of life is going to be poor. But I'm sorry. I know plenty of individuals.
Talk to Leela Hart.
This is my point. Who are you to tell a six-month-old that they're going to have a terrible quality of life? Isn't healthcare supposed to continue to improve time over time? People who are paralyzed, don't we have hope with Neuralink? Do we not have hope with other different products and things and medical innovations? Should we be just so quick to say that we should be killing children? Because, again, be clear on the language. We're not removing suffering. We're euthanizing people with a poison that is not studied for killing. And the last time it was during the eugenics movement. And it would just happen to be utilized in during the World War II time.
And just like as against it as I am, you can at least argue that people over 18 that are of sound mind are making their own decision. And if they want to kill themselves, really, there's not a way, a lot of ways for us to stop it.
But technically, but what do we understand about the prefrontal cortex and the frontal lobe in development in children?
Yep.
You do not have a fully developed frontal lobe until you're what, 25?
Well, right. And that's my point. And so, you know, anybody from 12 to 25 is, it's kind of debatable whether they're, you know, capable, especially, I mean, have you been in high school? Has anybody here been in high school and maybe been in a relationship perhaps? Like your emotions literally are as fluctuating as they'll ever will be. Your hormones are firing on all cylinders. We're being messed up from the poison in the food and water anyway. So we're sort of dysfunctional from the outset. But right, that was my point, was that as a baby, I mean, it's, you cannot frame it as anything other than murder. You can't even make the argument that, well, you know, they did want to die and we're just, you know, helping them do it in a safe way. No, these are babies, you are literally just murdering them. The idea that they could consent isn't even reality. So it's just murder.
Well, it is. And so, and then there's the argument that people have with me. Well, if they have informed consent, again, what is informed consent when the doctors are being taught a protocol and program that Health Canada can't legally see, that our tax dollars have paid for, and we can't even see? It's a closed, tight network, meaning CanMap has a conference, which, by the way, if any of you would like to protest it, it's happening in Montreal the end of April. I can't go. I'm popping a baby out. But you could go. It's in Montreal. I talked about it on Redacted. I said to Clayton, I said, feel free to go. You have to be a doctor to attend, but you don't to be outside.
Yeah.
And I'm just saying, this is where all of your doctors, the 2,200 doctors who are people who kill people, as part of their medical practice, are going to be discussing how to roll out and how to integrate this into society, how to speak about it, how to promote it, how to help people accept the idea as healthcare, we should be killing people. Yeah. And this is my argument. We are supposed to be the globe's gold standard of healthcare. So is it free will and actual choice if every other thing we do? So say, for example, I have terminal cancer, right? Well, you're more than likely going to die on a waiting list to see a doctor in Canada. 23,000 people die a year. That's not even including the people who leave the waiting rooms and die in the waiting rooms.
Oh my God.
Okay, so say I have terminal cancer and I need to see a doctor. Well, what if I can't see them in time and now it goes from like stage 4 to fully terminal? Okay, now we're in this hallway here. Now, what if you tell me I can't get access to, say I want to have ivermectin. Say I want ivermectin instead of a standard, you know, whatever it is.
You want to try something experimental.
I want to do something a little different. And the answer is no. So, okay, so now I'm going down further down the path. Now they say, well, we can't get you hospice or palliative care because, well, we don't have enough beds and enough funding. Okay, so now I'm at the end and I'm in excruciating pain and I don't have another solution, all because I wasn't given actual healthcare, actual medical support. Is it then still free will and choice if that's the only solution they're giving you is death?
Right.
So this is where I'm trying to understand people's argument. They say, but I see in a world where Kelsey, and look, I get it. I see in a world where, why can't you have compassion? Nobody wants to have, you know, this whole conversation around grandma can't function, can't eat her, she can't open her eyes. I am the most empathetic towards it, and genuinely so, because the difference between me and the death community is that person raised you, looked after you, put all their money into you, all their time into you, and brought you into this world. Do you not owe it to them to do the same thing as they leave? when we have this program in Canada called the Special Access Program, which is one of the hardest in the world to get access to, but it's regulated psilocybin. I'm actually one of the recipients of that program for treatment-resistant depression. Right. Out of like 180 people, I was given it after thousands of dollars in lawyers and proving that I was treatment-resistant. Health Canada's option to me was electroshock therapy. So before they would give me a mushroom, but what do we understand about end of life? We understand through Johns Hopkins and Harvard and all this amazing research done in America, because you're allowed to study it.
Yeah.
That regulated psilocybin in the right set and setting with your loved ones, with your family, with a pastor, with whomever you want, can be incredibly healing and helping you come to grips with what it means to be leaving this earth.
Yeah.
But we don't offer that. We can do MAID same day for track one. Within 24 hours, if you are a track one recipient, you get two MAID assessors, you can be killed same day. And we have over 200 patients that were killed that way in the Ontario Coroner Report.
How much do you think this is just purely a money thing where they just ran the numbers and they went, we provide, you know, end of life health care. Most of the money goes to the last 10 years of somebody's life. Yep. If we just kill them 10 years earlier, we save that much money. I mean, it's sickening to think that that's how these decisions are being made. It's obviously a contributing factor. How much do you think is this just the consequence of socialized medicine and money at the end of the day?
Well, if we want to get dark and sinister, let's go there. So there was a research study done by Western University, these two guys, and they did a if situation. So I'm very clear, because it was when I talked about it on Jillian Michaels, it went super viral. And they're like, we were only doing an if situation. That wasn't real. And I was like, but the law's going that way. So yeah. Is it if or more of a when?
Right.
And they broke down the amount of people they think over 2027 to 2047. So when made for mental illness, medical murder for mental illness up to 2047. And they ran the numbers based on the Indigenous people, the amount they would, the suicidal people, the mentally ill, the homeless, and then the elderly. And they came to a financial figure of $1.273 trillion. So anything with a T in front of it, friend, or a B, makes me think there's a lot of incentive financially. Now, that's not even just, that's just what the government of Health Canada, if, again, I said if they keep going, because this is where these groups come at me. If that is where we're going, which legislation looks as if it is, if it does, and that is the amount of money, that's just what the government stands to save. And you know that Carney loves to give another 2.5, a few billion here, a few billion there to Ukraine and all of our weapon systems like we just did. Oh, and $100 million grant to Indian students, but not white people.
Right.
So that's not even what the doctors are making. That's not even what the doctors are making.
Right. That's just saving on things that they're not supplying later.
Exactly. Yeah. And so in this, what you're kind of looking at here, this citizen here, right? This is Canada saying, you know, in less than 10 years, we're going to hit 100,000 deaths. That means your doctors in Canada have killed over 100,000 people. Do we understand that? Are we clear about that? That is not a few people. Like, do you remember during COVID when they shut stuff down, when they said 10,000 people have died from COVID? Well, Canada, we don't have the full figure for 2025 yet, but the most accurate figure we do have is 2024. That's 16,499. We're estimating over 17,000 for 2025. And again, in 2023, 4,528 track one deaths were same day. That means no family could step in. Nobody could set up palliative care. Nobody could set up hospice. Nobody could make a plan for grandma and grandpa. And that's 5% of the cases were same day deaths in 2023 alone. So that means that 4,000 people applied in the morning and were dead by bedtime.
No waiting period. No consultation with the family. Although that can get kind of iffy, right? Because we've seen who's the woman, who's the angel of death woman?
Oh, Ellen Weeb.
Ellen Weeb.
She's who killed Keanu.
And she's the one who says, you know, well, the biggest hurdle to get over is often the family. Yes. They're not okay with it. So, like, literally you have families like, don't kill my family member. And she's like, oh, you're a barrier to get over.
Yes.
But then on the other hand, you have a story from not too long ago of a husband who basically murdered his wife with the doctor. And the wife didn't want to do MAID.
This is B.
But the husband said, well, I can't take care of you anymore, so like Old Yeller behind the barn. I mean, so the families, you know, I guess it can go either way, but there's actually, I mean, can you tell us that story? What happened there?
Yeah, so I actually am writing about this one in the new book because Mrs. B's story is one of those warning signs for people. Dr. Ramona Coella, she's on the Ontario, she looks at the Ontario Coroner reports, but she's, you know, she's within the MAID Death Review Committee. Brilliant doctor. And she goes, there is a non-compliant list that we're looking at of over 400 people. Mrs. B was one of these ones, okay? Mrs. B had applied originally for MAID, but then made a decision that she no longer wanted it, okay? And instead of them saying, you know what, you're right, we get it, you've changed your mind, that's okay to make a different decision, she based it on her religion. She said, you know what, I've made a choice, I don't actually want to do this. Brilliant, love that for you, beautiful. And then what ended up happening is that she actually was MAIDed the same day. They couldn't get her hospice in time. They couldn't get her palliative care because they've been defunding these places like the Delta Hospice. People have seen her talk about Angelina Ireland. They defunded her because she refused to do MAID at her facility.
Right. You talked about that last time.
Yeah, right. And so this is important because if we can't get a doctor's appointment, we can't get an orthodontist appointment, we can't get an eye doctor appointment, we can't even get into an ER same day.
Right.
Why is it that we're so quick to have access for these people to come in and assess her?
That's a great question.
And then kill her. And so she was killed same day, even though she revoked and pulled back her rights. So when people say, well, Quebec is doing this thing called advance requests, okay? So say one of us, you and I, know we have the genetic component for Alzheimer's. And we're like, you know what? I'm going to sign a document now, okay? I'm going to sign it now so that when I'm 70 and I'm really like gone and I'm not, I can't make the decisions for myself, just, you know, put me out to pasture kind of vibe, right? Well, that happened in Europe, okay? So that happened to a lady in Europe. It's actually the very first story I wrote about in the book because it's so important. She had made the choice, did an advance request, and this is what Quebec is doing now, okay? And in that advance request, she said she wanted MAID. Well, she went to the doctor, and the doctor put a sedative in her coffee and didn't tell her. And then they started the procedure with the family around. Well, this grandmother actually came to consciously mid-procedure, and the doctor had the audacity, and has been cleared, by the way, and said to the family, please hold her down while I finish. And the family held her down while they finished euthanizing her. So if you tell me that's not some form of murder, I don't know how I can have a very simple conversation with you about it. You know, right before I came here, you know, I made the mistake of engaging on Twitter. I made the mistake of engaging on Twitter. And I thought, well, Michael Malice is good at it. I wonder if I could be funny too. I can't. Turns out I'm not a funny person, in case you guys haven't noticed. And ironically, I'm sitting there and this person tags me in something and I started laughing and I was like, are you serious? It's the Toronto Raptors content creator.
Okay.
Just did a tweet about me calling me an idiot.
The like basketball team or
the NBA's Toronto Raptor content creator. It literally just went viral because it just got picked up. I didn't know this was going to happen, but he went at me saying that like I'm uneducated and that this is fine and that we should be able to do this and all these things. And I actually went back at him anyway. It just got picked up. It's going completely viral. But the point is you're going to have people in the country where you live that are, because they've been so manipulated and slow dripped and told by doctor after doctor after doctor that this is the right thing to do to grandma, that they, again, he's the younger one and he had older people use it. And so now he's arguing with me on Twitter, not knowing who I am.
And it's being normalized. Yeah.
And it's being normalized.
Yeah.
So it's like trans, we got it normalized. And then we finally caught up. Trump caught up and was like, hey, we're going to stop it. But now this is their blind spot. This is Trump's blind spot. And this is obviously Mark Carney's blind spot because he needs the money. We need the money to go give it to Ukraine. We need the money to give it to the Indian people. We need the money to give it everywhere else but Canadians. So when people say, Kelsey, this is not actually happening, this isn't as bad as you think, I'm just early.
Yeah.
And so I need people to wrap their brain around 1 in 20 people. So if there's 20 people in this building right now, which there definitely is, one of those people is going to die by MAID, statistically.
That is astonishing. Yeah, 5% of the deaths are from MAID. And once it gets implemented, it's so much more difficult to ever extricate. So we need people now in America, like at least one person from every state needs to raise their hand and go, I'll handle it for Nevada. I'll handle it for Ohio, where you just keep your eye on the legislation. And when anything with MAID comes up, you got to go talk to your State House, because I guarantee the representatives in there, they aren't like excited to kill people. You know, as corrupt as a lot of them are, they're human beings. And
right.
But if all they have is some very well put together professional, a doctor from Canada coming down and saying, look, this is how it's done. It's very simple and easy and wonderful. And there's no problems. Vote yes. And then leaves. You have to come in after and go, let me tell you what really happens once this is implemented. They only have the other side in their ears right now. We need to be the other people. You cannot.
Yeah, that's the guy right there.
Expect other people. Raptors Shaq.
I know. So I guess he's the content creator for the Toronto Raptors for the NBA. And I said, dude, this can't be good for you to be doing this. And then it got picked up by Urban Canada. It's getting picked up all over. And right before it came here, I went, oh no, the NBA is going to hate this.
That's wild. And okay, people say crap like this and still believe they're a good, okay, so you're a bad person.
I'm
for
a bad person.
This.
And I'm also super incorrect.
It's one thing to be incorrect, another thing to be incorrect. Okay, so you're incorrect, cruel, and not a good person. Hold on, go back, guys. I want to read her tweet. We got to find out what makes her bad. So click on her tweet. You say, that person, if you understood the drugs, was paralyzed with lungs filled with fluid and drowned to death. Enjoy that reality.
I'm really harsh about it.
I mean, well, because it's a harsh thing. You're just describing what's actually happening.
I know, because I'm done. This is what happens when you change verbiage and you change language.
Yep.
And I'm done sugarcoating this. This is medical murder. This is giving up on your society. This is telling people they should quit and die. And then they should accept that killing grandma is the easy way out. We have the double blind. You can provide in hospice and palliative care a way so that patients are maybe given a little more morphine and they slowly slip with their loved ones there. Why are we scheduling this like it is an elective breast surgery?
Right.
You know what I'm saying? I'm not trying to come down on people making these decisions, but when people come to me and say, Grandpa looked peaceful, he was so still and so peaceful, I said, because they paralyze you first.
Yeah.
There's nothing peaceful about a paralytic.
I mean, the whole thing is, here's another stat that's pretty interesting that goes along to the point I was about to make.
Yeah.
I had to euthanize my dog about a month ago. It was like the hardest thing ever. And obviously, it's all the more difficult because you can't communicate with them. But it's like, who are these people that are so cavalier about taking a human life? It was like torture to put down my dog who clearly, you know, it was time, obviously, but it's like the fact that they care less about humans than dogs. And by the way, in 2021, nearly 10,000 Canadian people were euthanized. In 2021, a total of 9,842 Canadian people were euthanized. Only 2,000 shelter dogs in Canada were put down that year.
Yeah.
So five times as many human beings are euthanized in Canada as dogs, because there are no kill shelters. There are people that will.
Oh, there are. They're called Maid House. There's one in Victoria and one in Toronto. All they do is kill people. There's also Shoreline.
That's the opposite.
St. Paul's Hospital.
Well, but you know, dogs at least have people advocating for them and saying, hey, we shouldn't euthanize dogs. Where are the humans saying, let's not euthanize humans?
Well, and listen, so this was the argument. So I was really lucky. So Michael Malice called me and he goes, look, I think I need to talk about this publicly because I think it's important that people understand it. And I'm like, well, yeah, you're more people, I guess, like you better than me. And so like, talk about it, please. So he actually went on Joe Rogan. He went on Rogan a couple weeks ago and he goes, you know, he was talking to him and he said, Joe, look, like, do you know about the MAPE program? And he goes, yeah. And he goes, well, but Joe's response was, yeah, but what was wrong with her? Like, why did she need it? Because we don't want someone to suffer. And I agree with Joe. What was wrong where we needed to euthanize them? But where my line is our society cannot be trusted with this because it's euthanizing everybody.
Yeah.
This is not just grandma anymore. And it was funny because Malice pushed back and he goes, right, Joe, because do you remember when we started allowing people to wearing dresses and now we had to affirm their gender? Do you see where that goes?
Right.
Do you see where this goes?
Why can people not see the patterns and stop them before? It's like we're going to sit here. They're going to implement May. It's going to get really bad. And then people are going to realize and fight back. Why not fight back right now before it gets there?
And then I'm going to seem like a lunatic for saying, I told you so. And you didn't listen to the loud lady.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? I have empathy and I agree with what Joe is saying. Nobody should suffer on the end of their life, but we should be giving palliative care and hospice. And just for record, it's not, as Joe said, but we put dogs down. It's not the same. Actually, as putting dogs down, this was the clip here. It was not the same. We don't use pentobarbital. We do not use drugs that stop the heart right away. We use a cocktail that's never been studied, never been researched, all created by a doctor who was apparently used to deliver babies, but now had the audacity to create a protocol, sell it to Health Canada, and we can't see the IP.
Right.
So it's like, this is not, that's my pushback. It's like, Joe, but I hear you. But we don't euthanize the same way we kill dogs. That's, I mean, and it's still killing. But like, again, there's a time and a place for an animal. I've had to put dogs down. It's the worst thing in the world. But it is not the same drugs. It's not the same protocol.
It's just not the same situation.
No.
Even in the slightest. I forgot to bring this up. I should have brought it up earlier. But the other thing is that like 95% of the people killed in Canada are white.
96 and 96. America's 95.
So I think that's an aspect that maybe needs to be talked about, too.
I mean, listen, apparently I can't talk about it because I'm white. So, but let's talk about it any really briefly. Right now, 96% of the individuals of the 100,000 that have utilized the medical murder program in Canada are white. In America, 95% are. Do we think that's a coincidence that India is now partnered and China is now partnered with Canada and they're looking at bringing in millions and millions and millions and millions of more? Because what we do know about those populations is they don't put people in nursing homes. Yeah. They don't kill grandma. Okay.
Right.
They actually let grandma die. And we brought my other half here last time. And I said to him, please never put me in a nursing home. And he looked at me and he said, honey, I'm black and American. We don't do that.
Right.
We don't do
right.
that.
Right. Well, white people have been convinced.
White people have been convinced nursing homes is where they should go. And then that's where they slip in and convince them that it's easier to die.
It's so gross. Yeah. I mean, it's not like 95% of the people in Canada are white.
No.
It's massively an over-representation. Finally, an over-representation of white people that the powers are fine with. They're yeah. fine. There's no diversity in MADE. Maybe that could be a good move. Diversity in MADE. Get people to sign petitions to say we need to be killing more black and brown people.
Oh, my God. I guess that's
I mean,
oh my God.
That's what MADE is, right? And if it's good for us, isn't it good for everybody? If not, maybe we need to rethink some things.
Harrison said it.
Hey, it's... I'm making a point here. I think it's a good point. If it's such a good thing for white people, wouldn't it be good for everybody else? No, it's evil for everybody. And it has to stop for everybody. Kelsey Sheeran, thank you.